Call this meeting the Judiciary Committee to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, take your seats. Today we have four bills. We've got the procedural motion on House File 1138. Yeah. We've got House File 4100, Representative Mahoney, Representative Mahler's House File 3603, and we've got the pending referral on the COVID-19 emergency public health bill, which I think, as I understand this, we don't have, so we have to come back 15 minutes after session to take it up so that we get the committee report. But first, minutes of March 10th, 2020. Anyone review the March 10th minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I make a motion to move them.
Thank you. The minutes are moved. Any discussion? Representative Cantrell's motion. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. The next bill that we got up, one, two, three, four. Well, it's four to four, so I'm not going to take up a bill. I might have the votes on. I bet you will. Well, let's take up. Are you guys going to cause me problems on Mahoney's?
We just came from a really robust conversation.
I know you did. Oh, yeah, you're going to cause me problems on Mahoney's. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Scott.
We could take up Representative Mohler's bill.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You ready, Representative Mohler?
Is it a trick?
I just know that, Mr. Chair, I just think it'll probably be a longer discussion on yours just to kind of explain what you got going here.
That's
so.
Fair. That's fair. Next bill, House File 3603, Uniform Canadian Domestic Violence Reciprocity Act. Representative Mahler moves House File 3603 that it be placed on the general register, and you have an A1 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Does anyone have the amendment? Any discussion? All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A1 is amended. Representative Mahler, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this is the Uniform Law Commission's Act to recognize Canadian orders for protection. And just a quick note on the amendment really puts the law consistent with what Minnesota law's language is. Mr. Johnson put that together and spent a lot of time going through and making sure that, like, the terminology and some of the process involved in the bill is consistent with our state statutes, and I understand he's out today, but I do really appreciate all the work that he put into drafting that amendment. And I will turn this over to my testifiers, but just note that Minnesota recognizes orders for protections from other states, and Canada recognizes United States orders for protection. And I can let the testifiers here give a little more detail about what this bill does.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome back, Ms. Timmons. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, here before you as a Uniform Law Commissioner, and some of you may recognize me as the former reviser of statutes. House File 3603, with the author's amendment, will be the Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Canadian Orders for Protection Act. As Representative Mohler already said, Minnesota already recognizes these types of domestic violence protection orders from other states, and the act would expand the reciprocity to Canada. The act itself is short and straightforward. It really literally has four substantive provisions. Section 3 states that a state law enforcement officer, upon finding probable cause that a valid order has been violated, must enforce the terms of the Canadian order. Section 4 gives permissive authority for a court to enforce the terms of a Canadian order. Section 5 gives permissive authority to register a Canadian order but does not require it. And then Section 6 gives immunity to law enforcement officers and other governmental agencies, prosecuting attorneys, clerks of court, who are protected from civil or criminal liability for good faith enforcement of these Canadian orders. So it's pretty short and straightforward. I would note that it is an act that's a collaboration between the Uniform Law Commission and the Uniform Law Conference of Canada. It was worked out during the time that Commissioner and Judge Harriet Lansing was president of the Uniform Law Commission in the United States, has been enacted in Canada, in the provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and Quebec. And it's been enacted in 6 states, including our neighbors North Dakota and Wisconsin. And this year it's been introduced in Vermont this year, as well as Minnesota. Since the act was worked out under Judge Lansing's leadership, I'd like to ask her to say a few words.
Welcome. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lansing.
Thank you very much, Chairman Lesh and members of the committee. Minnesota, as we know, has consistently been a leader in drafting and enacting legislation for protection from domestic violence. And there are people in this room and who are here this morning who have done a lot of work on that, and I want to recognize and salute their work. A study conducted by the Permanent Bureau of the Hague Conference concluded that high levels of domestic violence and increasing cross-border mobility have made it clear that mechanisms are needed to enforce protection in cross-border circumstances. This conclusion is consistent with reports from a North American Leaders Summit that found high levels of domestic violence across Canada, Mexico, and the United States that warrants increasing attention and coordination on the enforcement of domestic violence protection orders. House File 3603 provides for the recognition and enforcement of Canadian orders for protection and strengthens Minnesota's existing web of protection against domestic violence. And I thank you for considering this act this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lansing. Go ahead, Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Michelle Timmons again. Mr. Chairman and members, we have two advocates here who are able to provide support for the act. And immediately to my right is Katie Kramer from Violence Free Minnesota.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself, Ms. Kramer.
Hi, Chair Lesh, members of the committee. My name is Katie Kramer. I'm the Policy Director for Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse, formerly the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. After 40 years as the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, it was time for us to update our name to reflect the vision that we work for every day, a violence-free Minnesota. We remain the statewide coalition with 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victim survivors in all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm testifying today in support of House File 3603, permitting Minnesota to recognize Canadian orders for protection. Victim survivors who come to Minnesota from Canada to travel, work, attend school, visit family, or relocate for their safety or for any other reason should expect that their protection orders will be enforced in all jurisdictions on either side of the border. An example of this need is a woman from a Canadian reserve who had a Canadian protective order. She came to Brainerd, Minnesota, and her abuser followed suit. Out of fear for her safety, she ended up in a domestic violence shelter. Because she came from the reserve, she was able to cross the border with just her tribal ID. In order to get an order for protection for the woman in Minnesota, the shelter had to secure an additional identification from Canada and then get a Minnesota protective order, resulting in delays, risk to her safety, and the experience of additional trauma. Had this law been in place, it would have streamlined this process for the victim. The woman in this example was fortunate in that she had connected with an advocacy program that could help her navigate these matters. For a victim who is here in Minnesota with a Canadian protective order, whose perpetrator follows her, who is afraid for her safety. That victim should be able to call law enforcement directly without a concern that Minnesota won't recognize Canadian orders for protection. Full faith and credit when a court in any jurisdiction will honor and enforce orders issued by courts in other jurisdictions is not a new concept. The Federal Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, enacted in 1994, gave protection orders the benefit of interjurisdictional enforcement through its full faith and credit provisions so that a valid order for protection may be enforced where it's issued and in all 50 states, tribal lands, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories. VAWA's full faith and credit provisions protect survivors' freedom of movement by requiring law enforcement and the courts to enforce protection orders throughout the country. We believe this legislation will help ensure survivor safety and offender accountability on either side of the border. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer, for your testimony. And you have another testifier as well, Ms. Mahler?
That's correct.
Welcome. Come on down to the table. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Thomas, and I am the Executive Director of Global Rights for Women. We are a locally based organization in Minneapolis. Most of our work is done at the invitation of partners around the world who are working to end violence against women through legal reform and systemic and social change. We draw on the in powerful history and legacy of Minnesota on ending violence against women. You may know that Minnesota was one of the first states in the world to enact an order for protection law in 1979, just right after Minnesota and or Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. It created the Duluth model of coordinated community response. It had the first shelter in St. Paul in 1972. All of these strategies and remedies for victims of violence are being replicated now around the world. In fact, just recently, the World Future Council gave the Duluth model of coordinated community response an international award for the best policy in addressing violence against women. The order for protection law that we have here in Minnesota has been a core reference point over the last 20 to 30 years with other countries who are drafting their first laws to end violence against women. And I think not very many people know that, and it's a wonderful example of our leadership. I think with House File 603, Minnesota has an opportunity to continue this powerful legacy as a role model in the global effort to end violence against women. I provided a little sheet of statistics there. I'll just name off a few of those. The World Health Organization states that 35% of women worldwide have experienced physical violence, and 30% of women who have been in a relationship report that they've had experience of some form or physical of sexual violence by their intimate partner. A really important report recently released by the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime found that 50,000 women around the world are killed every year by family members, mostly intimate partners. That's 137 women per day. So when we think about global pandemics, and that's exactly what the United Nations and the head of the World Bank and the World Health Organization and many other global leaders now are calling violence against women and girls, is a global pandemic. I would just reiterate to close what Judge Lansing said, and that is that policymakers worldwide are embracing the need for cross-border collaboration and cooperation to end violence against women. An example is the European Protection Order, which allows persons to benefit from a protection order issued in one member state of the European Union to be recognized and enforced in other states. This remedy, this order for protection, as Katie stated and Judge Lansing stated, is one of the most effective and important remedies for victims of violence. And Minnesota here has the opportunity to really embrace that and continue that leadership. Thank you very much, Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Thomas. Ripson Mahler, do you have any other testifiers today?
I don't, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3603 as amended. Please raise your hand. I see no one from the audience. We'll move to member questions. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill. I do have a few questions, and I think this bill kind of begs the question, are there other foreign laws that we enforce here in Minnesota? And maybe that's a question for Ms. Timmons, I'm not sure, but and if we do have other foreign laws that we kind of enforce, what are the nature of those? Are they mostly all safety related, if you know the answer to that?
Ms. Timmons, Judge Lansing, got his call out.
The Uniform Laws Commission does have an international component where we're working with other countries crafting and enacting laws reciprocally on a sort of one-on-one basis rather than on through a full treaty that we sign, which then we go more into the federal legal structure on that. So we have a number of things that the Uniform Law Commission has done, and I was trying to think of one. I know there are safety ones, and if Michelle and I just think hard about this, we'll be able to come up with one. We are working on one for that will be here next year that will have to do with health care directives, so that if you're in Canada or some other country that you can have your health care directive recognized and enforced if you become ill. And Canada is very interested in that. We meet with Canada on a regular basis to work out what we call harmonized laws so that we can have laws that are quite similar that will be easy to refer to and for people to seek enforcement of. I also, in my capacity with the Uniform Law Commission, am a fellow for the European Law Institute, and I've been working with them on digital safety and privacy issues, so we tend to try to get our laws to mirror each other. But I'm sure that we can come up with a couple of others and forward them to you.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there any negotiations or talking with Mexico right now? I know one of the testifiers mentioned the Canada-America-Mexico collaboration, I guess, for lack of a better word. So on this particular issue, is there anything going on there with Mexico?
That's a very good question. The Uniform Law Commission does have representatives from Mexico, and historically we have worked with them. We worked with them on nonprofit entities in trying to get some reciprocity on that, and they were very involved in it. We have had some difficulty in the last couple of years maintaining strong connection with them, but we continue to work on it. And Mexico is indeed one of the areas where we would like to get reciprocity. It's extremely valuable to have those systems in place so that we don't have some of the situations that Katie referred to where people don't have immediate access to safety issues. And Mexico would be a place that we need to work. Sometimes things move slowly, but you're asking these questions encourage us to keep on working so we can bring back some additional action in a place where we really need it.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm second author on this. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this forward. It's a very important bill. Something that you and I had talked about as we were looking through the language is we were wondering, and maybe you talked about this already. I had some disruption a couple times here coming in, so I apologize if I missed it. But can you just sort of walk through the steps of if a woman has this order but maybe doesn't have the paperwork anymore, is there any access to the Canadian database, like we have HRO and OFP databases now that all law enforcement can access? Thank goodness, it's been a while coming. And just wondering if there's that reciprocity where we can do that, or how does that functionally work if someone, do they have to have the physical paper, or is there an access?
Representative Mueller.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. So If there is a registered Canadian protection order, the VCA tells us that they can get that information through data pass from the judicial branch, so that information would be available. If there isn't that level of registration, then this allows probable cause determinations by law enforcement. And so I believe that would allow, you know, law enforcement, it wouldn't have to be a registered order for protection. They could make some phone calls. They could look up other databases that the victim might be able to point to. And I don't know if my testifiers want to add. They're nodding their head yes. But if, is there anything I'm missing here that you want to add?
Okay. Ms. Dennis? No? Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Representative O'Neill, I think the issue of access to databases is something we could maybe work on through the Uniform Law Commission. It's a good question. But in general, yes, the probable cause determination and the flexibility that that gives the law enforcement officer is the answer.
Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of those important details, you know, if somebody, if law enforcement rolls up on a scene and they say, well, I have a protection order, but there's no documentation, that puts them in kind of an awkward place, which is not unlike what we've had law enforcement do for quite some time with HROs. And, you know, that just went live a month ago, to have that accessible to all law enforcement before they're served. Mm-hmm. So just a question, as I've had to muddy through some of those waters for the last 10 years to try to figure those things out. Really important, the connection to databases so law enforcement can quickly and easily ascertain what's happening. Also, I was wondering, are there other states around us that have a similar relationship with Canada?
Ms. Dennis.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill and members. Yes, North Dakota and Wisconsin already have enacted the Uniform Act. And the other states that have enacted it include Washington State, California, Nevada, and Delaware. It's been introduced in Vermont this year as well as Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to hear we're moving in the right direction.
Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative O'Neill's question about verification rapidly was one of my questions that I think is key to this. And you may have already addressed this when I did walk in a minute. Does Canada enforce ours?
Ms. Dimmons.
Yes. The provinces of Manitoba, which is right to the north of us, as well as Saskatchewan and British Columbia, enforce our OFPs already, as does Quebec, which has more of a French-style civil code system, but they have a provision that enforces it. And then Peter Lown, the head of the Uniform Law Commission of Canada, assures us that their ULC equivalent is making this act a top priority for enforcement for the remainder of the Canadian provinces this year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to add to what Michelle has said, when we drafted the law as representatives of Minnesota for the Uniform Law Commission, we sat down at the table and had the Canadian representatives from each of the provinces participate with us, and Peter Lown, who's from, as Michelle said, the Uniform Law Conference of Canada. It was a really, it's an inspiring exchange to see that we can work together somewhat, you know, off the direct governmental corridor and then bring it into the places where it needs to be enacted, and that we can keep moving toward getting it done on a sort of harmonization basis. But they've been very, very helpful. They come to our Uniform Law Conference meetings. We're having our annual meeting in Madison this year, and the Canadians will be there. And they actually patterned their Uniform Law Commission after ours, and we just attended their 100th anniversary of being in existence. The Uniform Law Commission of the United States has been around since 1892, so it's nice to see, and now the European Law Institute is trying to pattern what has been done by the states in the EU as well. So it's been a very exhilarating thing to see that safety measures can be put in place through this cooperative working with Canada.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Ms. Timmons, always great to see you again. I've enjoyed working with you over the years. Judge Lansing, thank you for the work you're doing. Representative Mueller, thank you for bringing this forward. This is something that does need to be done, but I want to make sure that it's workable. I see there's in the bill you have provisions to protect the officers as long as they're acting in good faith. But I'm want to make sure we have the process down right. We have people in here that are either prosecuted or defended people that these charges up for violations in this room, but I'm probably the only person that's actually had to serve the papers and actually enforce the orders. My concern is that if we don't have access to the actual paper, it's hard to act in good faith. When we're at a scene, whether it's the papers are from a different state or even different area of the county or the country or the state or a different area of the country, we either have our dispatch get copies of it, whether it was through email or a fax, so we could actually read those papers. Because sometimes there's exclusions in those papers for the individual where they can sometimes be together dealing with issues. And we've had people call in the violation, but because of the exclusion, it was not a violation. So it's important for the officer or somebody working with that to actually physically read the paperwork. So I'm glad this is moving forward, but we need to figure out a way to make sure that the officer on the scene or somebody that he has contact with can actually have physical copies of that so they can make sure that they can act in good faith and not get into trouble with lawsuits and stuff. You can write the immunity into the law, but somebody still files the lawsuits and it still costs a lot of money, and sometimes even in good faith the officer gets in trouble.
Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill and to your testifiers. This is an issue that's certainly very important to me and my community. We've tragically had a domestic violence death in Maple Grove very recently. Very important. My husband used to volunteer as an attorney young in his career for volunteering to support domestic violence victims. This is something my family's been very well aware of. So I just have two questions. One, Chair Johnson covered a lot of the concerns I have, but the difference between what you say is enforceable about whether it's expired, who the order is, what the due process rights are, versus then just granting best faith, you know, good faith estimate of whether this is actually there, really is troublesome to me. And I think having some requirement, it doesn't have to be a certified copy of the order, but some, you know, a photo of the order or some documentation of the order, I think is so important for the protection of civil rights on and for our law enforcement. So I would just encourage you to continue to push for records access at some level. And I agree it doesn't have to be certified, but just somewhere to start to verify this is a real thing is very important. And then secondly, I just wondered, in the other states that have this reciprocity or enforce the Canadian orders right now, you listed Wisconsin, North Dakota, is that just a relationship with Canada, or does that include other countries as well? Thank you.
Ms. Timmons.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my understanding is that it is just with Canada to start, but yes, certainly the Uniform Law Commission is working with Mexico and has interest in expanding that further.
Seeing no other questions, I would say that Canada's system still comes from the common law, which is based on many of the same civil rights that we have. So I would presume that if there were a proposal from the Uniform Law Commission, it would take that into consideration if we were going to form these relationships, whether under VAWA or something else, that made sure that we protected the same civil rights in those documents we recognize, which can be confusing. There are a few times that I've received phone calls from Canadian law firms asking if I could represent a client of theirs in St. Paul, because that's where I was, and they were actually meaning St. Paul, the suburb of Winnipeg, Manitoba. And I get these documents with a little crown on the top and everything, and it just looks kind of like Greek to me. So I want to make sure that police officers can understand whatever it is that that they're getting on these as well. Seeing no other comments, committee discussion having been concluded and no other testifiers from the public, Chair Mahler's motion is that House File 3603 as amended be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 3603 as amended is placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Mahler, and to all the testifiers for being here. We are going to go in reverse order, and I'm going to, I apologize, Representative Fisher, but I'm going to make you wait again because we have a chair here and a commissioner here, and so they're going to go first. So, Chair Mahoney, come on up. And I move that House File 4100 be recommended to be re-referred to the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. I see no amendments, so Chair Mahoney, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a bill that I'm doing because I have two daughters. And women in this world get 20%, or I'm sorry, 80%, paid 80% of what a man gets paid. It's absolutely ridiculous when they're doing the same amount of work. You all know that I'm a pipe fitter. If a woman is working with me on a job site, she gets the same amount of money, same benefits, same everything. That's the way it should always be. If they're doing the same work, there should not be any pay gap. And one of the reasons that pay gap exists is that the HR or the hiring person can ask without any problems, how much did you make at your old job? And if you don't answer, you're not going to get the job. Or if you do answer, you're likely to get 20, 30% less. Totally unfair, particularly in this world where we have, unfortunately, we have a lot of single mothers that are not getting any other support. They need the same that us old white guys get. So with that, that's what this job, this bill does. It requires the, I could go into it a lot. I probably would be better off letting, after my last committee, I'd be better off allowing the, my testifiers to take over from here.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner, are you going to go first, or how are we going to do this?
Chairman Lesh, yes, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Jill Hasday. I'm a distinguished McKnight University professor and the Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. I teach sex discrimination law and constitutional law, among other subjects. In my time today, I would like to make one simple but fundamental point. Asking about pay history perpetuates pay discrimination. I'll start with some historical background before describing the current state of the law. Before 1963, it was perfectly legal for employers to pay women less. This type of discrimination was pervasive and out in the open. Newspaper help wanted ads would list one salary available to men and a lower salary available to women doing the same work. Many hoped that the Federal Equal Pay Act of 1963 would end pay discrimination between men and women. But 57 years after the law's enactment, an enormous wage differential persists. The median earnings for a woman working full-time and year-round in 2018 were just 81.6% of the median earnings for a male worker working full-time and year-round. The latest studies estimate that America's wage gap will not close for white women until 2055, for black women until 2130, and for Hispanic women until 2224. One important reason for this persistent wage gap is that employers frequently ask job applicants about their pay history before deciding what salary to offer. This widespread practice means that workers often cannot escape pay discrimination by seeking a new job. If a woman is paid less at one company, perhaps because her boss simply assumes that women deserve less, the consequences can reverberate for a lifetime. Discrimination early in a career can lock someone into a permanent cycle of unequal pay. Unfortunately, federal law does not prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. Indeed, federal law accepts, even encourages, the practice. Employers sued under the Federal Equal Pay Act for paying women less will commonly defend their unequal pay practices by contending that they set salaries relying on each job applicant's pay history. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which covers Minnesota, has accepted this argument, holding that it does not violate federal law for an employer to pay women less if the employer determined pay scales by relying on pay history. I'll repeat that because it's important. Federal law does not stop employers from paying women less for doing the same job as a male employee, so long as the employer can point to pay history as the basis for the discrimination. The ability to rely on pay history provides employers with a ready-made excuse for underpaying women, but efforts to amend federal law to prohibit employers from asking about job history have so far been unsuccessful. A growing number of states and localities have responded to this problem by enacting their own laws that bar employers from asking job applicants about pay history. These laws are aimed at ending the cycle of pay discrimination so that everyone can receive equal pay for equal work. The laws benefit women and anyone else with a history of being underpaid. To date, approximately 18 states and 21 localities have prohibited employers from asking job applicants about pay history. Minnesota should join this reform movement. Every Minnesotan deserves equal pay for equal work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Hasday. Commissioner, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I'm excited to speak with you today about this bill, House File 4100, which would ensure that employees are paid based on their experience, based on their skill, their track record, and responsibilities of the position, not on their salary history. When an employer makes salary decisions based on someone's salary history, it can continue the never-ending cycle of pay inequalities for women. Inequalities in pay perpetuate when further salaries are anchored to past salaries. That's why House File 4100 is an important step to closing the ever-persistent pay gap so that all Minnesotans can thrive. So these pay gaps are persistent and historical, as Professor Hasday talked about. A woman is so regularly paid less than a man with similar experience, qualifications, and seniority for the same job that we're compelled to ask, what practices or policies are perpetuating inequality in pay, resulting in this discriminatory outcome, even if there's no discriminatory intent? The pay gap is also so disparate. In 2018, women in Minnesota still earn approximately 80 cents to every dollar a man makes. For women of color, as was noted, that pay gap is substantially worse. Asian women earning 71 cents to the dollar, Black women earning 58 cents to the dollar, Native women 56 cents to the dollar, and Latinas 52 cents to every dollar a man makes. Given this, we are again compelled to ask what practices or procedures are perpetuating inequality in pay, resulting in this discriminatory outcome. So while there are many reasons for the pay gap, relying on an applicant's previous pay when setting the salary for a new job is one of these practices that often causes an inequality in pay by following women from job to job. That's why the pay history bill is so important. The pay history bill makes it clear that Minnesotans should be paid based on their experience, skills, track record, and responsibilities of the position. It would prohibit an employer from inquiring into, considering, or requiring the disclosure of one's salary history through the hiring and promotion process. When Minnesota passes this bill, it will be an important and proactive step in closing the pay gap. Minnesota will also join a groundswell of 18 states, including Missouri, Alabama, and North Carolina, that have already passed statutes to end pay history questions. As the state's civil rights enforcement agency, we're committed to ending discrimination so that every Minnesotan can live lives full of dignity and joy. I really look forward to working with all of you to move this forward. Be happy to answer any questions.
It's a great bill. You should vote for it.
Any other testifiers from the public who wish to be heard on House File 4100? I don't see any hands going up the audience, but we have a question from Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Professor and Chair Mahoney. I just really wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward so that we can finally catch up to Alabama and equitable measures in our law. You know, low pay, as you mentioned, Professor, low pay at someone's last job under this current practice means that they're going to be paid low at their next job and at the job after that, and it ends up propagating a cycle of not only underpayment but undervaluing in the marketplace. I, in anticipation of this bill hearing, I was just doing a little bit of research into kind of the history of asking for folks to disclose, or asking for prospective employees to disclose salary. It's meant to determine someone's market value. And I think that is unfortunate because women, people of color, people with disabilities have been dramatically undervalued in our society as it is, and this is just one more way in which that devaluing rather is being propagated currently in our employment law. So I think in the interest of not only equity and prosperity, but in the interest of fairness, we need to pass this bill, and we needed to pass it yesterday. But let's go catch up to Alabama. Thank you, Chair Mahoney. Thank you, Chair Lesh.
Chair Cassidy.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Were you able to identify other practices besides this that contribute to the pay gap? And if so, what were they?
Professor Hasday.
The pay gap is an enormous problem, and I think many different strategies will have to be used. This is just one of them. For instance, courts, in my view, aren't vigilantly enforcing existing statutory prohibitions on employment discrimination. They're often reluctant to acknowledge evidence of outright bias. But I think this statute is one important step. It's not the only one, but it's an important step.
Thank you, Professor Hasday. Seeing no other comments from the – oh, yeah, Representative Herb.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, and thank you, Representative Mahoney, for bringing this bill forward. It was really interesting. So I don't know how many people know this, but I have been working on a doctorate for way too long. And part of my dissertation that I'm working on is really looking at women, specifically Southeast Asian women's, their corporate climb and the barriers that they face and the pay that they have. And I just wanted to point out that I completely agree with everything you all are saying, and I just wanted to add that for women to actually make, like Asian women in some categories make the same as white men, but they have to have way more education and way more experience to get paid the same as a white man. And so this disparity carries on even after women get experience, after women have way more education, and that we continue to see this. And so this is just a small first step that we need to take in order to then look at all of the other disparities and how we can fix those as well. And I think that there will be ripple effects. So I appreciate this bill, and I think it's wonderful, and I hope that everyone supports it.
Chair Mahoney.
To Representative Herr, it's not just Asian women, it is all women that have to have more education and more experience and more and more and more, and that's not fair. The only place you don't find that is in the building trades.
Just a quick follow-up that it's just, I was just referring to my particular dissertation, and so I just want to make sure I'm not making statements for all categories of women, just what my research told me about Southeast Asian women.
I'll move the House File 4100.
I had a question.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, and I don't know to which testifier this goes to, but on the top of page 2, starting with 2.1 through 2.6, in my reading of that, I'm a little bit confused as to whether this language prohibits an employer from offering the same or a lower salary if the applicant offers their past pay history voluntarily?
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Lesh, Representative Scott, thank you for this question. I find this to be a little bit confusing as well, and I think this is an area where I'd love to work with you offline to clarify this a little bit. Certainly the intention is to end pay discrimination, and so we want to make sure that that's really clear to get towards that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so
is the intention of the law to require, if the information is past pay information is volunteered by the applicant, is the intent of the law to require the employer to pay at least what they were making before and or more? Is that the intent of the law?
Chair Lesh, Representative Scott, thank you. No, that is not the intent of the law. This is really intended to be able to say to employers, look, there's a lot of ways that you might know somebody's salary. For instance, us public employers, our salaries are public. My salary was published in the Pioneer Press when I was appointed. And so if somebody knows about what my pay is, people know things. They also know my sex. They might know that I'm Chicana. They might know things about me, but it's there to say that that can't be the reason for making the decision. And so it's actually there to protect employers.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Chair Scott.
Thank you. Just another question. On line 2.10, it lists there that there's a prohibition against discriminating based on membership or activity in a local commission. And I'm wondering what you had in mind there. Is that new language? Is that elsewhere in the human rights statute?
Commissioner Lucero?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, that's directly from the human rights statute, and I can find where that is and point it to you following this.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to know more specifically what that means.
Sure.
And then, I'm trying to find it. I read it last night, but I thought it was saying that, like when the pay is public, like with a state employee or whatever, and the information can be found in public records. I think it must be on page one towards, I don't know, somewhere between 116 and 121.
Yep.
But I didn't see any information there about counties or local cities, because a lot of times their employees' pay information is also public, and it didn't seem like that was included in the language. Maybe I'm remembering that wrong from last night reading it. But it's not just state employees or federal employees where their pay information is public. It's beyond that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Mahoney, I was actually talking to a couple friends of mine last night. Both are women, and they actually have a problem with this bill, because when they were asked about their wage, when they were applying for a new job, they told them, granted that they were looking for a work closer to home instead of driving down to the metro all the time. They actually told them their wage when they were asked. They ended up getting more money because they wanted them to work there. So this, if they went to ask their wage, they would have got paid less. So it works both ways, so we got to be careful to make sure we don't make things go backwards as well.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to request roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Mahoney. Nice to see you. So I'm very sympathetic to what you're trying to do. As a woman in different phases of my career, I have had more education and more experience and been paid less than my predecessor, so I know this is a real thing. But there are also points in my career where, because I chose to step out of the workforce for 10 years and was probably less productive at the time when computers were getting online and I was a little behind the technology curve, I was less productive and I went back to work, I needed time to catch up. So I think there's a lot of variables in what goes into salary, and I appreciate, Commissioner, that you referenced that about experience and level of training and productivity. Productivity is the main driver of wages, and I just think we have to keep that in mind. So with that in mind, I would like to just question about the strength of this and what the penalty is. So in line 1.11, it says that the employer cannot even consider from any source pay history. And then if they do that, it's an unfair discriminatory employment practice. This is line 116. Under section 36A, blah, blah, blah. Forgive the blah, blah, blahs. So I'm wondering, if you can't even consider pay history from any source. Like you said, yours is public. Like people, there's stuff in the ether. You just know. And if the test is you can't consider that, that seems very onerous if there is a penalty. So could you address that, and could you address what the penalty is, please?
Well, I could have Professor Haz to answer that, because you spoke to that a little bit in terms of the litigation reasons for this.
Okay, I have a, thanks for your question. I have, I think, a two-part answer. First, even controlling for factors like productivity, the wage gap remains largely unexplained. So one economic study controlled for race, region, unionization, education, occupation, work experience, 38% of the wage gap remained. So it's not an adequate account, all these other factors, although obviously that's something. The second thing is, a bill to stop employers from asking about job history just does that, no more, no less. Employers would remain free to set pay scales according to the level of education required, the time commitment, you know, the scarcity of the skills. In other words, there's still going to be people paid less and people paid more. It's just that it wouldn't be based on pay history. It would have to be based on the job itself rather than someone locked into a cycle of being consistently underpaid.
Okay. Representative Robbins?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I agree with that, maybe not asking directly, but the fact that they cannot consider information that's out there just seems a little bit of a stretch too far for me.
Commissioner Lucero?
Chair Lesh, thank you for that. So there's a lot of things that an employer knows about somebody that they are not or are prohibited from asking about. So you, again, might know that I'm a woman. You might know that I'm a woman of color. You might know that I might be of pregnancy-bearing age. These are all factors that we have said, hey, we don't want employers to be considering these because this is adding to discriminatory outcomes. And so if somebody knows something, that's fine. You know all these things about me. It's what are you actually basing your decisions on? And employers can base their decisions on all sorts of factors that are around the job itself and not around who I am as a person or the cycles of discrimination that have persisted before me.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions before the committee, then I don't see her. Do you see her? Okay. Then the motion before the committee is to move House File 4100 to be re-referred to the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. All in favor, signify by... Oh, yeah, roll call has been requested. Chair votes aye.
Representative Mohler.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
Aye, with reservation.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan.
Yes.
Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mariani. Representative Knorr.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Robbins. Representative
yes,
John.
Yes, but I look forward to seeing it in Jobs.
Representative Jean.
Yes.
Representative Albright.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, with reservations.
Got 14 ayes, 2 nays, and a handful of ayes with reservations. I don't know how to count those, but the motion passes. The bill is referred to Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair,
so, Representative Fisher, thank you very much for your patience. We do appreciate it.
Chair,
here from the beginning.
Chair Lesh.
Oh, right. Okay.
Chair Lesh.
Chair Johnson.
Representative Mariani. Or Representative Mueller. Or Mahoney. I'll get it right eventually. It's been a long
week.
We're going
to go through 134 before you got to him.
As this bill moves forward, if you could please consider the concerns that we have as we go forward and try to work on them.
Chat with them before. I'm sure we'll have
So, members, this bill is a rule 4.20 hearing, which means we're just going to take this up. I'm not going to, I haven't heard anything else really substantive about if any deals. Where is Representative Fisher? Yeah, come on up. So we're not going to take any public testimony, and it was fully debated last year, so the intent is just to move this to the general register. And there are no amendments?
There is a technical amendment, Mr. Chair. It's to change the date from January 1st, 2020. The effective date would be January 1st, 2021.
Okay.
So moved.
The technical amendment has been moved by Chair Considine. All in favor of the technical amendment, it's A5. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A5 is adopted. So it's our intent to just move this to the general register as stated. Any discussion? Seeing none, then the motion that the chair makes is that House File 1138, as amended, be re-referred to the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is as amended is re-referred to the general register.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you for hanging around for such a short.
You're welcome.
Thing. If you want to say anything else, you can.
Just want to say thank you to the committee to keep it going. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Short and sweet.
Yeah. Okay. So, members, we are going to recess because we don't have possession of the bill, and we have to get it processed, so it's in our possession. But before that, Chair Liebling, do you have testimony on it? Do you want to present it? Or?
Well, I Mr.
Got
Chair,
time now.
I think I could, if I could just present the bill right now,
yeah,
I think
go
we
ahead.
Could save
let's,
time
let's
later.
Go do that. We're all about saving time here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing this weird process we're in. I think everybody understands that with the COVID-19 issue, we're trying to move things very, very quickly, and also at the same time to really do this right. So I appreciate everybody's indulgence, and Representative Albright and I were just talking about this issue too, and he's, you know, I know all of us have concerns about what we're going to do, how we're going to approach the issue, and I really appreciate all of the input. So House File 4327 is going to be before this committee
your
later.
Your motion, Chair Liebling, your motion is that it be re-referred to the HHS Finance Division, your committee, and you have an
yes.
Author's amendment, the A4, is that right?
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair, I do. And so members, this what's before us is actually a clone bill. So this will come back to HHS. It's really the bill that you see in front of you has two pieces to it. Only one of them is really, I think, before this committee, and that is there are two pieces. One is an emergency powers piece, which I don't think there's anything that this committee, we can certainly talk about that if the chair chooses, but I think the reason it was here is because of this loan fund piece, which has a data provision in it. And there will be an amendment to that data provision. We've had some discussion about this, and Mr. Johnson, who's not here right now, has an amendment for me, and I think the amendment is kind of a, you know, we'll bring this probably into a shape that members will be much happier with.
Thank you,
that's
Chair Liebling. I actually do have a couple of questions about the peacetime emergency provision.
Okay, happy to answer those.
Just because, I don't know, in law school I did studies on the Commission on Public Safety that occurred during World War I and the influenza outbreak of 2018, the Spanish flu, which technically wasn't from Spain, it was from Kansas, but the soldiers that deployed to the front in World War I brought it to Spain, via Spain, and so they were the first reported cases, so it got called the Spanish flu. But there were some emergency powers that were enacted in Minnesota under the Commission on Public Safety that were, if anyone has read the research from Professor Hy Berman at the University of Minnesota, drastically implicated civil liberties
in the state to measures that we would consider outrageous to today. But if you can say, what does that mean in 12.31 that allows the governor to declare that peacetime emergency? What are the parameters and what are the implications for it?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm certainly not an expert on this. What we're doing in the bill is we're clarifying that a peacetime emergency includes a public health emergency. So if you notice in the current language, it says a peacetime declaration of emergency may be declared only when an act of nature, a technological failure, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's pretty logical that an outbreak is an act of nature. And so, you know, our contention is that it is. But in order to just be very clear that a public health emergency would be included within that, that's kind of what the bill is doing. And there's a definition then about what a public health emergency is, so that it isn't so broad that this can be used for just anything, that it has to be pretty serious. And you can read through under on lines 1.10 through 1.21 what the definition is, and that language is taken from other places in statute where this is defined. So it's kind of not a new definition, but meant to constrain both make it clear that a public health emergency is included in an act of nature, but also to make sure it's not so broad, because the Chapter 12 powers are pretty extensive. So that's the first piece of this. The only thing that's a real change is, if you'll notice on lines 2.14 to 2.15, it's giving an exception that a public health emergency may be continued up to 90 days instead of 30 for other kinds of emergencies. And the reason for that is because the Department of Health feels that just because of the nature of a public health emergency, like a contagion, that sort of the life cycle of it, it's likely to be a bit more of a trajectory than 30 days. So that's the idea here. And if you notice, too, these emergency powers are constrained. The governor doesn't just, there is some touching base with the legislature on this. It's not completely unconstrained to declare one of these. He can declare it for 5 days, and then the executive committee has to, I think if I remember this, executive committee has to do something, approve it, or it's here in the current language. I just didn't review this before coming here today.
And Chair Liebling, the reason I'm asking is, you know, this is one of those situations where there's a risk heavily reported on in the media. There's nervousness about increase in deaths. There are global things on the news. Everything's happening, and there's a lot of pressure for us to move quickly on measures. And I get that, absolutely. I'm going to, you know, support it when the bill comes before us. But I just want to make sure I totally understand what we're doing, because there's so many items in here. Like, I don't know what significant risk of substantial future harm really is. And I'm sure it's located elsewhere in statute, and there are probably examples of what that has been interpreted to mean by the courts. But I don't know if there's anyone here who could explain that to me. Maybe not.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think my testifiers weren't expecting me to be here presenting the bill this morning, so I don't think there's anybody here from the Department of Health. But, you know, I think that by the nature of this, there's going to be always some discretion. I mean, that's kind of the nature of this thing. We'll never be able to define completely, and that's why we've got here some safeguards. So a peacetime emergency must not be continued for more than 5 days unless extended by resolution of the Executive Council up to 30 days, except that a public health emergency may be continued for up to 90 days. So that would be by action of the Executive Council, which is, I think, is the governor, the secretary of state, I'm not sure who all. Again, this would be something maybe somebody from House Research would be more prepared to speak about. But it's not unconstrained authority. And the point was just that there was some concern that in this particular situation we're in, we're going to be out of session. The governor may have to, you know, move resources around. He may have to waive certain rules and regulations to get resources and treatment and testing and things like that to where it needs to be in the state. And that's why we wanted to make it super clear that he does have emergency power that extends to this type of emergency.
Understood. Is this anything that research can speak? I'm not going to put you on the spot, Ms. Mullen. I mean, if you can't. Oh, so is the question was, is significant risk of substantial future harm to a large number of people, is that defined elsewhere in statute? And has the courts, have the courts, I guess, interpreted or issued holdings on what significant risk to substantial future harm is anywhere?
Chair and members, that is not something I've looked into, but we can get you an answer and see if there's case law on that, if it has actually been litigated before.
Okay, that's fine. Do we know, do you happen to know, Chair Liebling, where else in statute this is taken from?
Mr. Chair, I think it might have been taken from the contingency account language. I'm not 100% certain about that, though, and I don't have that with me either.
Other questions? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, Representative Liebling, thank you for bringing this forward. I have some of the same concerns that Chair Lash brought up. Last night, in your caucus as well as ours, we had the governor in talking about this issue. And one thing that he stressed is be careful how much power you give him, because to make sure that we don't overextend that power. So I just want to make sure that we do this right. It doesn't matter who the governor is. We have to make sure, our job is to make sure that his duties are in check and not grant too much authority, but we need the right amount of authority. So as I read this, I do have a few concerns on it, but I think we can work some of those out. Where they talk about pandemic, my question is who's saying it's a pandemic? Is this Minnesota Health Department? Is it the Federal Health Department? I think we need to clarify who can actually say it's a pandemic for these issues to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along the lines of what Chair Johnson was just speaking to, I'm not clear, Representative Liebling, with this extension to the 90 days. And then if you look at that 90-day, the extension to 90 days, and then paragraph B right below that, it says that after 30 days, if the Executive Council extends for 30 days, at the end of that, it looks like the legislature, if they want to extend it beyond that, should be consulted, and we would have to come in and give that a continuing authority to the governor. And so my question is the 90 days continuous and the legislature wouldn't be called in until after 90 days, or would they still be consulted and brought back in after 30? And we have distinct a distinct role to play in all of this. There are three branches of government for a reason. And I look at the authorities in Chapter 12 given to the governor during an emergency like this, and one of the first ones is make, amend, and rescind the necessary orders and rules to carry out the provisions of this chapter and section. And it's very, very broad authority as far as spending money and far as enacting that he can call up the National Guard. There's a lot of things in that chapter that the governor can do, and regardless of who that governor might be, the legislature, I think our role is to provide a check and balance. So I don't know if you know the answer to that question, Representative Liebling. Is it a continuous 90 days without legislative input, or will we still be brought back in after the 30 days?
Chair Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, as you know, Representative Scott, I am not an expert on Chapter 12. This is existing authority except for the 90-day extension. I just want everyone to be really clear about that. And there's a reason that these are pretty extensive powers. And, you know, I agree with Governor Walz. He told our caucus as well, you know, you have to be careful that you don't upset the balance of power. I mean, we have seen a lot of upsetting of the balance of power lately, and it's not a good thing on the national level. So I think, you know, but if you look at this, the way I read this, you've got first of all, let's just understand that in a real emergency, you need somebody to be able to make kind of really fast decisions to protect the public health and safety. I just think there's no way around that. And that's why, you know, this chapter, I think, does constrain executive authority. Now, we may think overall that we need to do something in addition to change all of Chapter 12, like maybe as a body we think the whole thing is too unconstrained. I don't know. But for purposes of this, we're not giving him additional authority. The only thing that's really changing here is the 90-day. So as I'm reading this, it says in, you know, starting on 2.18, the legislature may terminate a peacetime emergency extending beyond 30 days. Now, I don't know how we do that if we're not in session, but that's Chapter 12. I mean, maybe we need to figure that one out. You know, I'm certainly open to that if anybody, you know, wants to try to do that. But, you know, I guess I'm not really seeing that. I mean, this is the executive council, you know, it's up to 90 days. I'm not really sure what happens. Oh, there we go. I'm sorry. Actually, maybe Ms. Clark, this could come and help me because she's been with House Research. She's been working on this. Thank you for coming down.
Okay, so, oh, yeah, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, just to answer that question, if the legislature is not in session and...
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Tharkfist from House Research. And to answer that question, if the legislature is not sitting and a peacetime emergency is extended for more than 30 days, the governor has to... call the legislature into session. That's in paragraph B.
So it was Ms. Clarvis?
Clarkfist.
Clarkfist, thank you.
Yep, sorry.
Okay, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm not sure why we have the 90 days then. If they're going to come back and consult the legislature after 30, and say yay or nay as far as can you continue this public health emergency. What if the legislature says no? Does that override the 90-day extension?
Ms. Clark, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Scott, as so often, I think you've identified a missing piece here, and I appreciate that. That's why we have these hearings, right? And I think we do need to kind of think about, right? That's how I think we need to think about that. I just think we didn't, you know, think that piece through. So I think you're right. The other piece, of course, is that if it's a pandemic, we may not want to reconvene, and we need to find some way. Well, then, of course, there's an issue of what if we need another 90 days? So I think there are some things to think about here for sure. And if you have thoughts about that, you know, I think this bill now, this piece, now I'm reminding everyone, this what's here is a clone. And there are actually two separate bills moving, and the one that has this is now in Ways and Means. But we can certainly amend it. And, you know, these things are moving really fast, and as I've said many times in this process, I really appreciate many eyes being on this because we really do need to get this right. So thank you.
Chair Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling. And I didn't bring this up to be political in any way. I was unclear on what the language was really saying. And I do know that there was probably a reason for that 30-day limitation initially, and that was probably to keep the separation of powers in check. And so I just want to make sure that we get this right moving forward, and I thank you for your comments.
And in light of that, Chair Scott, and we've got Representative Robbins next, I want to make sure people understand that this is actually the job that we were elected to do here, okay? I mean, a lot of times everyone does their homework ahead of time. Bills come in presented as a fait accompli. It's been heavily vetted by interest groups and everything, or we have Peace in the Valley or something, and so there's minimal questions to be asked, and those questions that are asked are like this. Well, when you got a pandemic, okay, this is where you make your money, okay, your per diem, okay, review the language and figure it out, because this is actually how they did it in the old days and how we're supposed to do it. So I particularly appreciate the questioning by anyone, so we make sure we can get it right, and I know Chair Liebling appreciates it as well. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling. I really do appreciate your leadership on this and the governor's leadership on this, and we all do really want to be partners in getting it right. And I had similar questions to Chair Scott and Chair Johnson, so I'll let you just continue to deal with that. I would say the other two questions I had were regarding on 1.12, where it says pandemic influenza or an outbreak of a communicable or infectious disease. I would just like some sort of qualifier on that, because any outbreak of any communicable or infectious disease seems low to me, unless pandemic is modifying those as well, but it doesn't seem to be. So I would just like you to take a look at that. And then secondly, because this is new territory for all of us, and this is of great concern for the powers we will be giving any future governor, my personal interest would be maybe in doing a very tight bill that says for the next calendar year until the next legislature convenes, we give the governor these powers or whatever, but these powers regarding public health emergency will expire, you know, at whatever date, January 2021, so that we have a chance to see how it worked and see what else is in there. I don't know that we need to give him unlimited power, or all future governors, this public health emergency unlimited powers. I think we could set some sort of a expiration date on just that public health emergency part of it and then reevaluate. And I think that would serve future governors and future legislatures well.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Robbins, you know, I guess what I would say to that is that when the legislature comes back in session, we can always change and reevaluate. And I'm pretty sure that with the things that we're doing right now to try to deal with the COVID-19 issue, that we're going to have to be reevaluating when we come back, both these kinds of things and the money pieces and a lot of stuff. I mean, we're going to learn and change from this emergency. So I would really be reluctant to put a sunset on these kinds of powers, because you just don't know. You know, if you sunset these powers, first of all, I want to emphasize again, we view this as a clarification of existing law other than the 90-day piece, right? So if we were to sunset this, I think we'd be saying to a future court, we really don't think this is part of current law. And then if there's an emergency in the meantime and this thing is needed, we'd be in deep trouble. So I really would be reluctant to do it that way. The other piece to your first part of your question, this section has to be read together. So it's an infectious pandemic influenza or an outbreak of a communicable disease or infectious disease that, and then you've got the 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's, I think maybe Ms. Clarkfist can speak to it, but I would say that that is constrained exactly as your, I think your concern is exactly met in the language. But Ms. Clarkfist, do you want to comment on that, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, I would say that the clauses following, starting on line 1.13, those qualify communicable or infectious disease, so that the disease has to meet at least one of those criteria.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling and your testifier. I'm just concerned that it's fairly broad if only one of those tests has to be met for a communicable or infectious disease. And to the other point, I was just suggesting a sunset on the public health emergency part of the emergency powers, not all the existing law. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Ramza, I understood that. I'm just saying for the emergency part, I mean, when you try to clarify something, I think the risk you sometimes run is that if you don't actually clarify it, then the court might think that it wasn't in there to begin with. And I'm worried about that. So if we are saying this is something that's going to sunset, then we're saying it's not really a clarification, it's a new power. And it's not a new power. I believe this is already there, other than the 90-day. Okay? So that's why I'm saying I would be very reluctant to put a sunset on this and then have it be expire, and then somebody says, oh, now you don't have that power. And then we have an emergency that requires this kind of emergency. So I just think that complicates it unnecessarily, perhaps, who knows. But, you know, again, when the legislature's in session, we can, if it's turned out to be not workable or too broad or something, we can always address it at that point.
We have Chair Johnson, Cantrell, O'Neill, Barr, Albright, Scott. We have 6 minutes left. We are going to recess and reconvene after 6 minutes. But what would be really super cool is if folks could get some of the questions that they have asked between now and when we reconvene. What? Well, I'm going to go to him. You're on the list.
No, he wanted. I want it before we get to break today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my question is with a clone bill, so there's two bills moving, or the amendment process and how we match everything up. It's a procedural question. So what do I'm just asking so we can work this afternoon. How do we approach this?
Well, if you had questions about the bill, you can address them to this one. And anything that comes through here, if there were, like, I don't know, questions or changes, that would be done on this bill before we reconvened. And I would likely waive amendment deadlines for these as well, considering the speed at which we're trying to proceed here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair, well, we've got 5 more minutes. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, Representative Liebling. I always have concerns when we rush bills through because we usually get them wrong, and I want to make sure we get this one right. For those of you who don't know, if I remember correctly, the executive committee is the governor, the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. It's the other elected body, not the legislature, which you can give up to a 30-day extension. Representative Liebling, I'd make one suggestion to a change on this, on that 90-day.
Sure, Liebling.
We have 30 days from the time, or you have 5 days and the executive committee meets, they extend it to 30. I would suggest that the legislature have to be contacted and get approval for that next 60 days. That would get us involved as well and give the checks and balances and see what it's like after, when we're pushing that 30 days, see what things are going. And then we get involved as well. And it's a good check on the power.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Liebling, for all of your extremely diligent work on this. Just for clarification, I did just want to say from lines 1.13 to lines 1.21, that is language that is included in statute 144.4199, and that is our public health response contingency account. So this is criteria that exists already in statute, and I think it's a fairly high bar to reach. And so I just wanted to put that out there to the committee. I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate your work on this, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Chair Lesh.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this forward. On the first page, I'm looking at sort of what I would consider the lowest bars of when this is enacted or taken place. And because of what Representative Robbins pointed out about it being a communicable infectious disease, so then I went through the 4 points, and I realize this is already in statute, but if you could just say in front of the committee, help us understand the definition on line 1.20 when it says, poses a significant risk of harm to a large number of people. Can you explain what that bar would be, poses a significant risk of harm? If maybe there's a statutory definition of what harm is. I know what bodily harm is. I don't know what, in this particular part of statute, what it means as a significant risk of harm.
Sure, Liebling.
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. I don't know. I mean, this is taken as, thank you, Representative Cantrell, this was taken from existing statute. And again, I don't have the Department of Health here to talk about this. I don't know if Ms. Clarkfist can shed any more light on this. And she's our House researcher who works with the Health Department, and you know, but you know, this is existing statute. So Ms. Clarkfist may have an additional comment on that. I don't know.
Ms. Clarkfist.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, I'm not aware of any other definition or bar in the public health response contingency account language or elsewhere in statute to further define or clarify those terms.
Mr. Chair.
O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would, even though it's already in statute, I'd like to know where this has been used before, because to me that's the lowest bar of the four factors. And I think it's incredibly important that we know when this trigger can be, you know, it can be triggered. So I think it's really important that collectively we as the body understand what those words mean, and we get that on the public record so that we all know what we're talking about. I think it's incredibly important. So again, that's line 1.20, poses a significant risk of harm to a large number of people. To me, that seems to be the lowest bar of the four factors, and I want to know when that can be triggered. So if we could get that clarification moving forward.
And I would, I would say, Rep. O'Neill, also that significant risk of substantial future harm, mm-hmm. which is purely speculative, that's pretty broad as well. I just want to make sure I understand that if there are parallels, which is why I asked Ms. Mullins if there was applicability either by administrative decision or court decision. So I don't know, but I just like to kind of know.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I, you know, like you had pointed out, this is the important work of this committee, and every single word, as you know, matter, and it's the difference between something being triggered or not. So I appreciate you digging even further in to see that as well. But that is the important work of the committee, and it's, we can't really make an informed decision until we know what those words actually mean and what it actually can be enacted.
Sure, and to be clear, what I think, and we'll go to you, Chair Liebling, before we recess, and after that, when we return from recess, we'll have the bill in our possession to which we can apply the amendment, and then we'll go to questions from Barr, Albright, and Scott. I expect that members that we are going to pass this and some version through this body as well, and I suspect everyone's going to vote for it as well too, just based upon the public health emergency nature of it. I just want to understand it a little bit better. You got the final word before we go to recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I really appreciate the input. You know, we just, this has been done very quickly, as everyone pointed out. And I also appreciate Chair Johnson's comments, which I think are a very good suggestion. We can consider that. We did take this language from the contingency fund, but there is a substantial difference. That involves spending money only. This involves a whole lot of other kinds of power. So I think you're making a very good point that it may not be appropriate to just simply put all of this into the Emergency Powers Act. So we will certainly think about that. And, you know, I really appreciate that input.
Members, we are going to reconvene at what time?
15 minutes after
floor session adjourns. And it will be in room 200. Committee is in recess. Judiciary Committee is called back to order from our recess of earlier today, and we are on questions from members. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we actually have the bill in our possession now, right? So
yes, we do.
Can I offer the
actually what we're going to do is we're going to do the
questions first.
We have an amendment first, right? We have your amendment. Is it author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, we do. We have the author's amendment.
Because I'm assuming sure your A20 amendment is drafted to the bill as amended by the author's amendment. So
I hope so. Yes.
So let's adopt the author's amendment first.
And Mr. Chair, is that I think that's
the A4.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to move the bill.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I'd like to move House File 4327 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Health and Human Service.
That is your motion.
Division.
That is the motion we have before us, and Chair Liebling then moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A4 amendment is adopted. And so now we have Representative Barr. Go ahead. You have the A20 amendment?
A18 is what I've got.
Oh, A20-718.
Yes, sorry.
I don't think I have that, Mr. Chair.
It deletes the new language on lines 14 and 15 of page 2, which is except that a public health emergency may be continued for up to 90 days. It takes that language out.
Correct.
Go ahead, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. The reason I offered this is the governor, through consultation with the executive council, has up to 30 days already for this kind of authority, the language currently continues on that if he needs authority past 30 days, he does need to call the legislature back into session. And if it gets past 30 days, I think we should be consulted anyway, so we should not allow this for 3 months for the governor to basically have. And this is a lot of authority to give to any governor. 30 days, I believe, is enough without legislative input. That's why I offered the amendment. I hope you can consider this as a friendly amendment.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, Representative Barr, I think the concern is a good one, but I think that your solution is a little bit extreme. And we've been talking in the interim about an idea that was put forward by Chair Johnson, which I think draws a more nuanced response to this issue, because the problem I see there is that we may not want to come back. If there's really a pandemic, we may not want to come back into session, and that would basically force us to do that. I think it would be better, kind of the way he was suggesting it, to have a check back in with the legislature, the ability for us to come in and then end the thing, kind of doing it the other way. So more of an opt-out than an opt-in, because of the nature of the situation that we could be having. So I'm more than willing to consider this. I think we share a concern about runaway executive power. And in fact, the governor came to both our caucuses apparently and said, don't give the executive too much power. And I agree with him. I mean, there is a reason we are a legislature, and we are here, each one of us, fulfilling what we think is our duty to our state. And that's really important to me and to all of us. So we want to get this right, but we're also seeing that we could be facing a pretty serious situation where we don't want to come back. And if we set it up so that we have to come back to continue the emergency powers, that could be not a good situation. So I think there's and also, you know what, I'd like to ask Margaret Kelly, if she's ready, to come down and sit here with me from the Department of Health.
Sure.
She's here now to answer questions from members. But I would just say, I think we're getting some other language drafted. Ms. Clarkvist from House Research is working on another more amendment language that the department, I think, has worked on, and that is kind of along the lines of what Chair Johnson was bringing to us. And I haven't seen that language, but I don't know if you would want Ms. Kelly to speak to that, but I would just say I would ask members not to support this amendment at this time, although I certainly am on board with you on the concern.
Sorry, go ahead, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I will withdraw the amendment for now, but if there's not something that addresses those concerns when it hits the floor, I will have the amendment back on the floor, if that's okay with you. Well, I guess it's not really okay with you. I can offer the amendment if I want to, but this is a concern, and I will be offering this if there's not, and I will give you the latitude to try and come up with a more nuanced solution.
We'll do it in a Minnesota way.
Representative
okay
Barr, I would expect nothing less.
Too much passive aggressive, sorry.
Okay, thank you, Representative Barr. I am as interested as anyone in making sure that we sand the edges off anything that comes through in a hurry, but next on the list is Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, and I apologize, it's been a few hours since we covered this, but Representative Liebling, in the DE6-1 amendment, I'm looking at lines 5.8 through 5.12. And I just, for the record, I just want to understand when we're talking about data sets, and it says that the data will remain private, who is going to maintain that privacy?
Chair Lieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. First of all, I want to clarify for members, I think there are different versions of this bill, and I think what Representative Albright is talking about is the A4 amendment. Right? Am I right, Representative Albright? Because you're looking, there's another version moving. I apologize for all this. It's just a fact
from the speech. Well, you said 5.12. Are you talking about the A4, Representative Albright?
One moment, please.
This is the amendment we just adopted.
Representative Liebling, as I look at the A4 amendment that amends the 3980DE6-1.
So, Representative Albright, if I could.
That's not the right
the
one.
DE6-1, this committee doesn't know from the DE6-1. That's not in this committee. I apologize for this.
To the A4 amendment, Representative Liebling, when it talks about data remaining private, both for individuals or non-public data, business plans, and the list goes on, who is going to be responsible for maintaining the privacy of that data?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would turn to Ms. Rydrick, who's sitting next to me, and she's the expert on that.
Go ahead, Ms. Rydrick. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at the Department of Health. And Representative Albright, as this language gives the Department of Health authority to administer the grant and loan fund, the staff who would be involved in administering the program would have the responsibility to keep the data appropriately protected as private, as we do with any other data that we have responsibility to hold.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Representative.
Sir, was it Ms. Rogers or Ms. Ryberg?
Mr. Chair, neither one. Rydrick.
Oh, Rydrick. Rydrick.
Nobody ever gets it right.
Just to be fair, I still struggle with her name.
Rydrick. Okay, excellent. You good, Representative Albright?
Just one follow-up. And Representative Liebling, you and I talked about this at the conclusion of our committee hearing this morning, but I do think it's important that the information that we talked about is disseminated to the rest of the committee. But we talk a lot about, or we did this morning talk a lot about, the power vested to the governorship. But I think it's also important to appreciate what is vested in the health commissioner. And it's not so much the separation, but where do those duties lie? I understand, as Representative Liebling said to me, the governor has the wherewithal and the veracity to terminate a commissioner at any point in time. But I'm just wondering, what can the health commissioner do that is not elaborated here on at their own discretion?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health.
I'm sorry, could you say your name again?
Margaret Kelly,
thank
Deputy
you,
Commissioner at the Department of Health. And before I answer that question, I just want to take this opportunity to remind you all that if you are sick at home, you should stay at home. And if you're at work and you start feeling sick, like a fever or chills or aches or sniffles, you should go home. And if you feel you need to go to the doctor, you should call first to let them know you're coming in. Given that, the Commissioner of Health has the authority in law to isolate and quarantine individuals in the event of an infectious disease or communicable disease outbreak. Currently, we are not invoking that authority. We are asking people to self-isolate or to self-quarantine. I don't know if we have invoked that authority maybe once in the recent past for tuberculosis. It is not something we often use. We rely on individual participation in our requests. And in fact, the federal level, quarantining folks who are on the cruise ship is something that had not been done since, I believe, the 1960s.
So, Ms. Kelly, as a follow-on to that, thank you, Mr. Chair, would the governor invoke that, or would it be unilaterally to the commissioner by virtue of the authority vested in that position by the governor?
Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the commissioner's authority is in statute in 144 and is separate from the governor's emergency powers authority. And I believe that the commissioner can invoke those. I don't recall if she needs to consult with the governor or not. I would have to consult.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, we do have some amendments that could be handed out now.
Let's do that then. Hand out some amendments.
Did I miss something?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
The commissioner has the authority in law to isolate and quarantine individuals under her authority without consultation with the governor.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Albright.
That's it.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to reiterate some of Representative Barr's concerns. And if I were rewriting this thing, I would do something about that 90 days, because if you leave the language the way it is, there's a conflict, because that 90 days does not is not consistent with paragraph B that's below that. And so I think we need to look at something less than 90 days, maybe 60 days. And I understand we don't know how long this thing is going to last, but within 60 days, hopefully the legislature could come back. The other issue is, I've since found out, my idea this morning was we need to have something in place where legislators can – we can convene remotely when there's a situation like this, or war breaks out, I don't know, whatever the situation may be, but in very extenuating circumstances and exigent circumstances where we can, I don't know if it's teleconference, what it is, but my understanding now is that it's in the Constitution that we have to do our business in this county. And so it would require a constitutional amendment, which we really don't have time for right now. So, but I think that's something that we need to look at in the future just as a precaution, because, gosh, there's going to be instances like this where we may not be able to make it back to the Capitol, but it's still important that we do our jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. So that's all the questions I have for members, and we've got the amendments.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move the A6 amendment.
The A6 amendment. Why don't you tell us about that, Chair Liebling?
So maybe I could ask Ms. Clarkvist, if she's here.
Ms. Clarkvist?
Yeah, maybe I could ask her to come up. And this, since this is a page and line and I'm just seeing it for the first time myself, maybe she could just explain what it does.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Clarkvist.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist from House Research. So the A6 amendment makes three changes to Section 2 of the bill. The first one is on line 2.15. It clarifies that it's a peacetime emergency that's the type of emergency that can be extended, not a public health emergency. So starting after the comma on line 3.14, it'll read, except that a peacetime emergency declared due to a public health emergency may be extended by resolution of the Executive Council for up to 90 days. So it makes that clause consistent with the preceding portion of the sentence. The next two changes are made to paragraph B. In the second sentence, it clarifies that the scope of that sentence applies to peacetime emergencies that are declared for any reason other than a public health emergency. And then the new sentence sets up a procedure for peacetime emergencies that are declared due to a public health emergency. And it says if that kind of emergency is extended beyond 30 days and when the legislature is not in session, the governor must call the legislature into session unless or if requested jointly by the Speaker and the Senate President.
Okay, thank you. Any other conversation on this? I'm compelled to point out, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Clarkvest, does, upon the call of the governor to convene both houses, do they have to accept?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, do you mean in a peacetime emergency that's declared due to a public health emergency?
Yes.
No, the governor would only convene both houses if the Speaker and the Senate President agree.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Clarkvest, does this amendment presume that the legislature or either chamber has adjourned sine die?
Ms. Clarkvest?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Matt Gehring could help me with that question.
But it doesn't say it in there, so I'm guessing the answer is no. But Mr. Gehring? While they're conversing about this, I did want to point out that Ms. Mullen did send me an answer to my question about the origins of this legislation. This was immediate post 9/11 legislation that was model legislation passed in many different states. The 2.22 to 2.24 outlining the permissive parameters of the governor's authority over the National Guard has changed substantially under federal law since 9/11, when 9/11 happened and we decided we were going to have wars in two countries on top of an existing tax cut. The federal government realized they didn't have enough money to do that, and so they said, reserve component, you're up. We pay you 39 training days a year as opposed to 365. That's how we can go to war and still pay for it. But what happened over the course of that time was that the ability of governors to limit the use of their own National Guards was substantially abrogated under another federal security act, and that meant that the current governor, once the National Guard representative was put on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has virtually no authority over our own National Guard in the face of being activated under Title 10. I realize this sounds like inane, but it is very relevant because to the extent that a national health emergency occurs in some other state and all of our National Guard members are federalized because they serve under the National Guard Bureau and are mobilized to a different region of the country, we have zero ability to have the National Guard control any kind of public health emergency in the state of Minnesota because they're all gone and there's not a darn thing the governor can do about it. So it may be neither here nor there, but I think it's relevant based upon assumptions we're making of the public health assets we'll have here to help control it. That's it. Anyway, go ahead, Chair Liebling. Oh, no, Mr. Gehring, you're going on. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from House Research. Representative Albright, the way I understood your question was whether the session that would be convened under this amendment would be a special session or not. Is that what you're asking?
Whether we had adjourned sine die. Does it assume whether we adjourned sine die?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I don't think it makes an assumption either way. So you could have a public health emergency in either sort of year of the biennium, and so this would effectively require the governor to call a special session at any time, regardless of whether the session has been adjourned sine die.
Mr. Gehring, and the reason I ask that is because on line 1.8, it says is not in session. My presumption is that would, again, infer that we are sine die adjourned, correct? And the reason I ask that, why I think it's important, is because under the current protocol, my presumption. My understanding is the governor can call a special session or call us back into session. It's not at the request of the House and the Senate, is it?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's correct. So the constitutional process is, gives the governor authority to call a special session at any time he or she deems necessary.
Okay.
Chair.
Chair Liebling.
So Representative Albright, as I'm understanding it, I mean, what this does is it you know, we often struggle with this, right? When some of us think there should be a special session for something, the governor won't call it, or, you know, we've been in this a lot, whether it's after sine die or just between, during the interim. So I don't know that part of it makes any difference, but I think what this is doing is it says, if requested jointly by the Speaker of the House and the Senate President. So in other words, it shifts the control over a special session to the House and Senate in this situation to tell the governor, you must call a special session. Now, since I guess I would wonder if that is constitutional, since the governor, because it does seem to bump up against the prerogative of the governor to call the special session. I don't know how that works, Mr. Gehring. Maybe that's is that kind of where you're going?
Representative Liebling, exactly to the point. I think we might be diluting what is already in the Constitution from the perspective of if for other reasons, such as a special session, the governor is requesting and calling us back into session. It seems like we're setting up and stipulating a special set of circumstances under Section 144 that isn't in the Constitution but for an express purpose. And I wonder if we're setting a precedent here that could be diluted and used in other means other than what is in the Constitution already, which is kind of the bedrock of what the three equal branches of government are aligned for.
Representative Liebling.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think that's what the statute is already doing, isn't it? Because because there's already in here language, the governor must issue a call immediately convening both houses of the legislature. I mean, that's current law.
I understand so that, Representative Liebling, but you go further to say if requested violation. Jointly.
Hold on a second. Representative Albright.
But you're going beyond that then to say if requested jointly.
Right. Yeah. I don't know why anyone would put in legislation the governor must do. I would, if it were me, I'd just say this must happen. Because what if the governor decided not to? Then you got to go to court, get a writ of mandamus issued, forcing the governor to do his job. I don't know, but that's just me. Anyway, did you want to suggest any other modifications, Mr. Albright?
While the intent is certainly appreciated, I think it's problematic.
Okay. Well, considering the speed at which we're moving in this, I know that this entire thing is a work in progress, and I know that Chair Liebling will make tweaks where necessary between here and when we get to the floor. So,
and Mr. Chair, if I may.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. And you know what? Representative Albright, I didn't draft this language either, and everything's happening really fast. I see that the problem there, and I think what Chair Johnson had kind of suggested before was a process where there would be a consultation with, I don't think he could speak for himself, but I don't think it was contemplating calling back the legislature. I think it was getting authorization from a wider circle of people to continue the emergency. And that is how this language ended up. So I think there's still room to work on this a little bit, but I like I think the direction is a good one, right, where we're not just opening it up for 90, but we're saying something has to happen after 30 to continue the authorization.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I've been listening to this, I'm wondering if we can strike on the last sentence of the amendment 1.9, strike everything beginning with the word if. So put the period after legislature. In other words, to create the requirement that we come back into session after 30 days, but it's not contingent upon agreement of the Speaker of the House and the Senate majority. Because also another problem is you have the word and. What if the Speaker of the House wanted to come into session, but they didn't agree, right? Or based on a catastrophe that might be happening, I don't know the succession line of the Senate President. Let's say first and second were completely indisposed, and there wasn't a Senate President to be able to agree. So just putting the burden on, after 30 days, the governor must call. So it's not contingent upon an agreement.
Chair Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, I think your point about, you know, the Speaker and the Senate President, maybe, you know, that's a different concern. But I kind of think you're going the other way, because the concerns that have been expressed here are, can we, by statute, make the governor call a special session when the Constitution gives him or her that authority? I think that's the concern. We need a way. So rather than, I would say, rather than messing around with calling special sessions, I would say we probably need to go back to Chair Johnson's original idea, I think, which was just to put in maybe a few more people who have to be consulted and in the loop before we continue a public health emergency that way. You know, that would be my thought. I mean, something like that. But I think what you're doing kind of goes the wrong way. It just tells the governor to do it without what this is drafted to do, is to give the Senate and the House the ability to get back into session to stop this thing. And what you're doing is taking out our ability to make that request and just putting it on the governor. And the point is, we might not want to come back into session. Everybody might agree that this is a bad emergency. We don't want to come back. What your suggestion is doing is telling us we have to come back under those circumstances. I just think you're kind of, we need to, this is hard to do on the fly, let's face it.
It is, but you're doing great, Chair Liebling, on the fly. Representative Lucero?
Great, and I agree. This is on the fly, and we're just trying to throw stuff on the table to get it to come in. I'm just trying to think of these scenarios, get an agreement. Also, what if there were members of the legislature that did or did not want to come in? It gives the power just to two people, right? And there may be dissension among the 201 within the bodies, right? There may be, there isn't a consensus or unanimous opinion. So, yeah. Anyway, we're doing it on the fly, and I get it.
Okay, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm an advocate for leaving that language in subdivision 2 that starts on the top of page 2. I'm a believer in leaving it intact. I think it's fine the way it is. And because even with this amendment, you're now giving the authority to extend again to the executive council, which again is the executive branch. It's not the legislative branch. And if we're trying to get away from centralizing power in the executive branch, and keeping in mind what the governor told each of our caucuses yesterday, don't give me too much power, and he used to be in the legislative branch when he was in Congress, he understands that delicate balance. So I think we're making this a bigger thing than it has to be. I think there's a way to do it with current language. They put the 30 days in there for a reason, and if other states adopted it at 30 days, I think the reason is because of that balance of power issue. Because during states of emergency, you're asking the executive branch to wield a lot of power, make a lot of decisions that ordinarily are made by the legislative branch. So I really appreciate you trying to figure out a way, and I think the way is to leave it the way it is. But thanks for offering the language, Representative or Chair Liebling.
Chair Liebling.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I just want to say to all members, you know, you don't have to tell me that you're trying to help, because I know we're all trying to help. So let's just give that as a given. This committee is really good that way, right? And we get a lot of good products out of this committee for that reason. So let's just kind of put all that stuff aside. We're working here, and I think we might have some language that might kind of help this. So I think the real concern, and I, Representative Scott, I think you're absolutely right. We want to make sure this is a legislative input decision. We don't want to give all our power to the executive branch. You know, we're so afraid that we let somebody else do what we should be doing and make our decisions for us. We don't want that. So I think that what we could do is, if we, in the amendment, if instead of, so on line 1.3 of the amendment, right now it says that the public health emergency may be continued by resolution of the executive council for up to 90 days. That could say by resolution of the legislative advisory commission, which consists of, I know I'm on that, Chair Benson's on that right now. Mr. Gehring, who else is on that? It's a mix of.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So the Legislative Advisory Commission, the membership sort of depends on the substance that they're considering at the time, but it includes as permanent members the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Finance Chair, the Speaker of the House, and the House Ways and Means Committee Chair. And then there are others, as I said, depending on the substance that's being considered, other members also sit on the commission.
So, Mr. Chair, this is a, so that's a process that's kind of well established that's been used. In fact, that process was used to release that first pot of public health money that was in the account. And it was very quick. It was a process where MMB sent out a request, and then I voted, all the members of the LAC voted by email. So it went really fast, but we did vote. And there's a section on that, which maybe Mr. Gehring could tell us more about, but that might be a way to balance this. I just would put that out there for members' consideration. So if in the amendment, instead of by resolution of the executive committee, which would now be online, I kind of write these in my main bill. So line 2.15 of the bill would now say, except that a peacetime emergency declared due to a public health emergency may be continued by resolution of the Legislative Advisory Commission for up to 90 days. So that, and then we could get rid of the rest of that about calling new special sessions and all that because we wouldn't need it.
Normally I'd have research repeat what the amendment is, but we are sans. Why don't I just have you repeat that? This is on the A6 amendment. And what line is this going in on? Chair Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, we adopted the A6, so I don't know what process is. We didn't. I'm sorry. We didn't adopt it. Okay, so good. Okay. So I think that the
1.3 of the amendment.
It's such a long week. I have no voice.
You're next on the list.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I think what we would be doing would be on line. So now I'm on the A6 amendment.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So on line 1.3 of the A6 amendment, we would strike the words executive council and put in legislative. What's it? Legislative Advisory Commission. And then we would strike lines 1.4 to 1.9.
Even do we? Do we need to reference a statute number where a Legislative Advisory Commission is defined in statute, or do we think that's unnecessary?
Oh, yeah.
Huh? I mean, just because, you know.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Reference a statute number as, you know, Legislative Advisory Commission as defined in chapter blah, blah, blah.
Mr. Chair, so the Legislative Advisory Commission is codified in section 3.30.
That's the statute, 3.30? Okay. All right, then.
So maybe Mr. Gehring could restate the amendment then with the appropriate.
Sure.
I heard there's a reference to the Legislative Advisory Commission up to 90 days.
What? Not in this oral amendment.
That's in the underlying bill.
Got it.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
underline 2.15 and the underline bill.
So I'll restate it. So on line 1.3, well, on line 1.3 of the A6 amendment, strike the words Executive Council and replace them with Legislative Advisory Commission as defined in Minnesota Statute 3.30. And strike lines 1.4 to 1.9. We cool?
Mr. Chair.
Was that Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So with that modification of the A6, does that affect anything in the bill as amended on line 2.15 through 2.17?
I don't know, why would it?
So we still have the for a continuance of up to 90 days.
Yes.
Okay. Chair Lesh, may I ask a question of Mr. Gehring?
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Gehring, if everything after the comma on line 2.14 was stricken, so you strike 2.15, 2.16, and 2.17, and you just end with, by resolution of the Executive Council, up to 30 days, period. What would that force on day 31?
Mr. Gehring, I mean, we're kind of asking for a little bit of speculation, but go ahead and speculate.
There's got to be some kind of procedure that's established in law.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I guess I need to think about that a little bit. I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
That's fair. Do you, let me ask you this. Do you have an idea in your head of what you think it would trigger, Representative Albright?
I think I do.
Well, why don't you tell us?
I think it actually would then incite the governor to call for a special session.
If we weren't in session.
If a special session was warranted. But I think it actually goes back to the constitutional power vested with the governor to then decide what needs to be done, which invokes the authority and the collaboration with the legislature. I just wonder if we're trying to make more of something than what already would happen.
Well, we don't really do that around here that much.
That's why I'm on the committee, Mr. Chair. Just to stir
Understood.
The pot.
Maybe we could do this. Maybe we could think about this and what was brought up, because I'm not sure I necessarily disagree with Representative Albright on that. Think about that. What's the next step on this, Chair?
So,
Lieberman?
Mr. Chair, this is going back to Health and Human Services Finance, but actually, since this is a clone bill, whatever this committee passes, we will take and do an amendment in Ways and Means. That's kind of the plan.
Okay.
So, because the bill right now that contains this language is in Ways and Means.
Got it. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, also, I think that the counsel for the Department of Health also brought up another little issue, and I think it might behoove us to, if we want to do this here, if you still do, to kind of let them work it out a little bit before we try to vote on it.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I didn't really hear what Representative Albright was concerned about. I don't want to make you repeat it, but we could, if I need to know, you might need to repeat it.
Can you repeat it, Representative Albright?
Representative Liebling, I think when I look at lines 2.15 and 2.16 particularly, I think that we're trying to accommodate something that would already happen under constitutional authority. So if you went back to line 2.14 and ended after days, the question then begets asking, well, then what would happen? And my assertion is that it would force the governor, by his constitutional authority, to call us into session.
If he wanted to continue.
If he wanted to. But so this continuation of 90 days, I think that's our hang-up. But But if we remove that, I think it actually avails us to what's already in statute under constitutional authority that the governor possesses.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you for that. I love the thinking that's going on here. I think the problem with that, Representative Albright, is that that would force us to come back in special session or force the governor to call us back. You might not want to come back. There's this kind of emergency, and that basically says he can't continue to have the powers he needs unless the legislature is able to come back in special session. And I think that puts us in a very dangerous spot that this is meant to take care of in general. And that's the concern. What if there's a pandemic? Members are already nervous. Should we really be here? Those questions are here. If there's a serious pandemic in the state, do we want to make the governor literally call us back into session in order to continue to handle the emergency? I don't think we do.
Chair Lesh.
Chair Albright.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. The governor has the constitutional authority at that point to call us back into session, or under Chapter 12, he also is vested in the opportunity, basically under the disaster provisions, to decide what is in the best interests of the state under the disaster provisions in Chapter 12. But I think what it does is it forces the governor to discuss the options. We're talking about circumstances that we have never dealt with. Hopefully we'll never deal with them again, but the point being is that they may be different next time. And so our Constitution has served us quite well since 1858. I think that we're dabbling in a gray area that I don't think that we have to, because of not only what's in Chapter 144, but also Chapter 12 with regard to the power that's vested to the governor already. And I think to the remarks that he's made in both caucuses, when he said, don't give me too much power, I think we've already given him what he necessarily needs to take care of the decision-making process, either invoking the legislature to collaborate with him or do it on his own if there is a fear of coming back together again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, I understand I think we're on the same page in terms of what we want to have happen and how we all want to balance this out. I just think the language you're proposing, as I understand it, kind of cuts off his ability to do that. I mean,
understanding. Okay, we're all hashing this out here. I'm willing to bet there's someone in this room or listen to us on the feed or whatever who has a pretty good idea that they know the answer to this or what they need to happen, but they're just all going to let us look dumb if we pass this out of here and then fix it somewhere hereafter. So if there's someone who is an expert in this area, raise your hand or come on down now. If not, I'm just going to call on Considine. Go ahead, Chair Considine.
Thank you. Can I ask Representative Albright to yield to a question? Could you enumerate a little bit on that Chapter 12, what he would be able to do after the 30 days, please?
Chair Considine, I have the book open to that chapter in my office right now, and if you'll indulge me, I'd be happy to go and get it.
I
got one over here.
Okay, good.
Ooh, there's this one.
I didn't take it.
I took it. While he's sifting through that, we're going to go to Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Liebling, I appreciate what you're trying to do. For me, I'm trying to make sure the legislature's involved in these decisions. Part of it might be the law enforcement part of me, but if we have to come back, even in dangerous situations, we need to come back. That's what we're elected to do. We only need to have 68 people here if they all vote for it. And it passes. Senate only needs 34. And if we're coming back in a special session, generally things are worked out so we know exactly what we're going to do ahead of time. It's just, I want to make sure that the majority leader, minority leaders in the House, in the Senate, know exactly what's going on and involved in the process to make sure things are done right to keep the legislature involved. I did look at 3.30. We'd have to rewrite that chapter, that section as well, because the only authority they have is $5,000 to $10,000 worth of finances to move from one area to another, and that's the only duties they have is financial. So I understand where Representative Albright is. I know also the health department said on these situations they need about 90 days to keep that curve low so our health care system doesn't get overloaded. And if we can keep it from getting overloaded, everybody's going to be much better off instead of that huge spike where we overload the system and unfortunately people's health is at risk because we don't have the facilities to take care of them. But that's what I was trying to do. I hope you understand, and I appreciate the work you did on this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Representative Considine, the innumerable distinctions in Chapter 12, starting with 12.28, where it describes the governor's orders, rules, and enforcements, and then it also goes to 12.29, where a declaration of a local emergency. It also goes to 12.301, where there is a talk of community disaster loans, governor's authority. Then on the next page, 12.31, subdivision 3, effective declaration of peacetime emergency, 12.32, governor's orders and rules effect, 12.33, assistance between political subdivisions. I think we've got it covered.
I'm actually fairly comfortable with that. I, if we've got a way for the governor to move forward, and it sounds like we do, do you have some, will you yield for a question? Is there still a concern as to, Chapter 12 seems to outline it pretty well.
Can I interrupt and call on Chair Scott invoking the ghost of Mary Liz Holberg? Who is speaking to us from beyond the legislative grave. Go ahead, Chair Scott.
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So, hello, Mary Liz. I know you're listening. What she texted me is, the need to call special session is only to extend special powers. If they don't need special power, they don't need to call a special session.
Representative Carlson.
I'm good.
Okay. Chair Liebling, go ahead.
So Mr. Chair and members, what I think would make sense to move forward here is the piece about putting the legislative, I keep losing the name, the Legislative Advisory Commission. That's because, we also have another LAC, which is the Legislative Audit Commission, which I'm on, so I'm having trouble with this. But the Legislative Advisory Commission, I don't think, Chair Johnson, that you're quite accurate about what that does. And maybe Mr. Guerin could talk about that a little bit more, because what that process is. But, I think we should put that in as into the amendment as being you have to bring that group in and get authorization to continue for the other 60 days. And maybe what we ought to do, in fact, Mr. Chair, is bring the health department back up to talk about why they need the 90 and why they think 90 might be, more the trajectory of what could happen. So that's the first piece. I also want to put on the table that counsel for the agency has also pointed out to me that we do have an inconsistency here that we need to attend to, which is in part B, and I could have him come up and explain that. But
yeah, have him come up. If you call him up, where are they?
Come on up. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robin Benson. I am interim chief legal counsel for the Minnesota Department of Health.
Go ahead.
So for the members' discussion regarding paragraph B and the mandatory call to special session and how to resolve that, if the committee adopts the amendment regarding the extension to 90 days by the legislative advisory council or commission, the LAC, then there still needs to be an exception made in that paragraph B so that on day 30, it's not triggered, because it's always triggered by default if there's a peacetime emergency. So what I recommend is following just before the sentence about the National Guard that the chair was describing earlier, at the end of the preceding sentence, insert except when the peacetime emergency is a public health emergency that has been extended by resolution of the LAC, spelled out. With that change, then you're looking at the extension of up to 90 days being taken care of if it is extended by the LAC, and there is no trigger to call a session. You're relying entirely on the LAC at that point.
So, Chair Liebling, we already have an oral amendment before us to the A6 amendment, neither of which have been adopted. I'm not going to entertain another potential oral amendment until we've resolved the other one. What do you want to do?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that what Mr. Benson's telling us is we kind of have to do them both together. I mean, I think I would ask the committee to let's adopt that first oral amendment, putting the LAC in instead of the executive council, because that brings in the legislature and gives legislative authority being required. I think that's what the LAC does. Mr. Gehring's nodding his head. It brings in legislative authority into the mix in order to extend more than 30 days. So I would adopt that, and then I would want to maybe, and then.
So the amendment we have before us, currently, as stated by Mr. Gehring, says on line 1.3 of the A6 amendment, delete executive council and replace it with legislative advisory commission. But what we're saying now is it's legislative advisory council.
Oh, which is.
Someone,
don't ask me for that. I can't get it straight. Commission.
Legislative Advisory Commission, as defined under Minnesota Statute 3.30, and delete lines 1.4 to 1.9 of the A6 amendment. That's current. That's the current oral amendment before us to the A6 amendment.
Correct.
The additional, what you're proposing as an additional oral amendment is after line, on line 2.21, after the word legislature, insert the words, except when the, what?
Mr. Chair, so if we look at the A6 amendment document, at 1.6 of that document, what we would, if we use that as our framework, instead of after the period on line 21, we would change.
Okay, so you're revoking your desire for your previous one.
No.
He's just clarifying on here.
I'm clarifying which side of the period we're going to put this on. So on line 21 of the bill, at the end of that, it says legislature, then a period. Before the period is where we would then insert the exception that I could state again.
You'd need to state it again because I can't even write that fast.
So line 2.21, before the period at the end of it,
and after legislature, insert comma, except when?
Except when the peacetime emergency is a public health emergency that has been extended by resolution of the Legislative Advisory Commission, suppose we could put extended up to 90 days, but I think extended probably takes care
of it. Okay, I got as far as extended. Okay. What's after that?
Except when the public, when the peacetime emergency is a public health emergency that has been extended.
Extended, yeah.
By resolution of the Legislative Advisory Commission.
Okay. All right. 1 second. Any other comments on that from committee members? Chair Scott.
Are we getting ready to vote, or what? I'm about to. You're asking for comments right now before we vote?
Yeah.
That, okay.
Yeah.
According to that. And I don't think ceding the power to the entire legislature to four people or a small group of people even is the right thing to do. I don't even know if it's, you know, I'm not a constitutional person, but I don't know that that would pass constitutional muster. And I think the thing to do is just to delete the language on the base bill that's on 214 to 215. We can reconvene. They're already getting the 30 days. They'll get another 30 days if they need it. They'll get another 30 days after that. And now I would entertain changing the from 90 days, I would entertain moving that to 45 or 60 days. But I think 90 days, 3 months is a long time. And so
Mr. Benson, why do you need 90 days?
Well, maybe we could ask Ms. Kelly.
Ms. Kelly, why do you need 90 days?
Yeah. It's only the public
health. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two things. One, I think the governor's statements to you were sincere that, you know, he wants to be sure that you all are in partnership on what you agree to do here, that these are enormous powers that you're turning over to the governor in time of emergency. But second, I think the interest on the part of the commissioner to have it be something greater than 30 days is a couple of things. That one, we don't see infectious outbreaks resolved quickly, and they ebb and flow. And what we're experiencing right now with this outbreak is that it is changing day to day and every couple of days. And so what we think might be the best thing to do today is going to change. Right now we've had, I believe, 9 cases reported. They all have been travel related. But at some point in this outbreak, we're going to see cases reported that come from community spread. Mm-hmm. What we know in other countries is that community spread can oftentimes be within a family, but we may also see it happen within a community. So as it moves from travel related to community spread within a family, the community spread within the community, our mitigation strategies and what you want the governor to do to protect the health of Minnesotans may change through that period of time. And it may be that we don't have all the answers within a 30-day period of time, which is why the commissioner is advising to extend it beyond something like that. Now, if that is through current law that requires the governor to call you all back to do it in 38-day increments, you may not, as Representative Leaving said, you may not want to be called back. We may be advising that large groups of people not meet and not congregate. And I don't know how we would resolve that issue with the need to come back and extend an emergency powers.
Deputy Commissioner Kelly, of the 27 states that had adopted this model language in the wake of 9/11, how many states have extended the 30 days in the model language out to 90 in what you're proposing? Or anything other than the original model language is 30 days?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how many other states have language with the public health emergency in it.
Well, I'm just reading off of Ms. Mullen's earlier memo that she sent to me regarding the questions I had from earlier and the number of states that had it. So if you don't know, you don't know. Oh, I'm sorry, 38 states, not 27, it's 38 states. Chair Scott, did you have?
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple more points. And I think what we might be confusing here is if we have to come back in 30 days, or if it extends beyond, well, let me back up. So if we reach that 30-day mark that's in current law, that doesn't mean that the Department of Health can't continue to operate under, you know, quarantining people and, you know, isolating people and continuing on with those policies. It's, this wouldn't take that away from the Department of Health. They would be able to continue on with whatever the best practices are. But this is just saying if there are decisions, this is a check and balance. If the governor, whoever that person may be, is making decisions that maybe the legislature doesn't agree with or the public doesn't agree with, this is an opportunity for the legislature to come back and say, you know, we've granted you these special powers, and so now we need to take a look at what you're doing with those special powers. So I think that we're fine leaving it at the 30 days because the Department of Health can go ahead and continue on with whatever those policies are that they feel are best for public health. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
Representative, we would be able to continue on with the authority we have in Chapter 144 around isolation and quarantine. But if we found the need to call out the National Guard to help staff our nursing homes or to help transport patients from one location to another, that ability would end, and we would need to reconvene the legislature to extend that ability. There are some powers that may need to be invoked that the commissioner cannot do without the authority under emergency powers.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. When we have special session, when we call a special session for other emergencies that we've had, those that can make it, and those that can't, don't. And as Representative Johnson said, you know, we just need 68 people in the House, and we need 34 people in the Senate. So I'll be quiet now.
Well, last word, Representative Albright. last word, Representative Albright.
Yeah, so thank you, Representative Neal. She... I think she found the answer to our riddle. So in statute chapter 3.30, it talks about the Legislative Advisory Commission, and I'll just read it. A general contingent appropriation for each year of the biennium is authorized in the amount of the legislature deems sufficient. Additional special contingent appropriations as the legislature deems necessary are authorized. Transfers from the appropriation to the appropriation of the various departments and agencies may be made by the Commissioner of Management Budget subject to the following provisions. A, transfers may be authorized by the Commissioner of Management and Budget not exceeding $5,000 for the same purpose for any quarterly period. B, transfers exceeding $5,000 but not exceeding $10,000 may be authorized by the Commissioner of Management and Budget with the approval of the Governor. C, transfers exceeding $10,000 may be authorized by the governor, but no transfer exceeding $10,000 may be made until the governor has consulted the Legislative Advisory Commission and it has made its recommendation on the transfer. Its recommendation is advisory only. Failure or refusal of the commission to make a recommendation is a negative recommendation. So I think it's already in statute in terms of what we've been struggling with. The Legislative Advisory Commission is already going to be consulted. So if the whole legislature can't come here, the LAC in statute already has the ability or the right to be consulted by the governor for transfers of exceeding $10,000.
Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
Representative Albrecht, I believe that, and I would defer to House Research and House Counsel, I believe that particular section of statute refers to transfers made out of the state's contingency fund, which has about $500,000 in it. But for certain reasons, certain purposes, one use of that fund is when we have a transition from one governor to another, and that fund is used to set up the transition office of the new governor. That's not in statute, but that's what the fund is used for. And so there is a request to the LAC to transfer more than $10,000 out of that fund to pay for that transitional office. I believe that what that consultation is referring to is specifically the use of that contingent account.
Representative Albright.
Chair Lesh and Deputy Commissioner, I'm I'm only citing what I see here, and I don't see that it identifies an account. It just speaks to a general contingent appropriation. So if that speaks to an account that, you know, that is all that you talk about, I still think it has applicability for what we're talking about here.
Representative Barr, last comment question before we vote on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess more of just a comment. Representative Scott or Chair Scott pretty much said what I wanted to say as far as the kind of lost my train of thought here, thinking about something else, but the 30-day part anyway. Throughout our history as a union, there have been numerous times where legislatures have been put under amazing stress. The Virginia State Legislature was chased out of Richmond at gunpoint less than 12 hours after the British Army took the town of Richmond, and they all fled on horseback. The Maryland Legislature in 1961 was surrounded by the Union Army when they were taking a vote. The Capitol was surrounded by the Union Army while they were taking a vote whether to secede or stay in the Union. We've had insurrections. We've had all kinds of different things. And to think that legislators today are any less virulent in their duty is a little bit, it kind of shocks me that we would not rise to the duty we've been called to do or volunteered to do when we said we want to be legislators or part of this august body. And that's pretty much my reason for the 30 days. We should never, ever give a single person or a council that much authority for even a couple of days, in my mind, leave alone 30. And 90 is just atrocious to me. I'm sorry, but
thank you, Representative Barr. Just my only comments, I hope I'm not wrong. I am a little bit nervous about voting for 90 days, Chair Liebling. I'm going to vote for it, but I don't know. I could see both sides of this going bad if we pass or if we didn't pass it. I hope I'm not proven wrong about it, but it is a lot of power. And we've talked before and also know that once you cede authority to the executive, you never get it back, ever. You just don't. I hope it's for good reason and it's not going to be a mistake extended to 90. I didn't hear really a good reason from Deputy Commissioner Kelly as to why they really needed 90. I was hoping to hear something along the lines of the incubation period of a particular virus or more viruses, but I didn't. I just heard, well, we just thought it would be a better idea. And, of course, the executive always thinks it's going to be a better idea to extend authority. That would be what I was saying if I was saying in that seat as well. But last word before we vote, go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the really good discussion. I think we all have the same concern, and I really appreciate this. This is moving very fast. This is much messier than we usually try to do in committee. This is making me think that perhaps the way to thread the needle here is to, we can't do this right now, but maybe we need to have a special provision for this that doesn't open up every power in Chapter 12, but only opens up those powers that really could be reasonably related to what kind of things happen in a public health emergency. So I could see that being a way to thread the needle, kind of being a little more intentional about writing a separate section for this and not just saying, okay, for this thing, because the package of powers under Chapter 12 is very broad. And maybe the governor under a public health emergency really doesn't need all of that. I don't personally understand enough about how extensive those powers really are. But maybe I could continue to work with the department about being more specific about what powers would be needed for possibly 90 days. And, you have my commitment to, if that makes sense to anybody, I don't know if it makes sense to them. But, we could certainly take a look at that and try to thread that needle a little more closely so that we're not just, I am very aware that we don't want to, either with money or with authority, allow people to use emergencies to kind of bootstrap all kinds of stuff, right? We're all very wary of that, so I'm very appreciative of everybody's point of view here, and will, you know, do my best to try to work this and make it work.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Chair Liebling. I said to you that that was going to be the last word, but I got a half dozen more people on the list now. So raise your hand if you got to be heard on this. Chair Constantine, Chair Mariani, Chair Scott. Who else? Okay. But Chair Mariani was first. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief, and I apologize, Representative Liebling. It's appropriate that you do have the last word here. But I am going to vote for this, and for the record, because I think the issues being raised here, these are not partisan issues. These are, I'm feeling like you are, Mr. Chair. But the comfort I have is that we're talking about an action here that's limited to public health emergency, and we're defining what that is quite specifically in the first section here. I think if we were talking about something much broader than that, I would be super incredibly uncomfortable. So, Mr. Chair, that's it.
Thank you, Chair Constantine.
Like you, Chair Lesh, I never did hear a specific reason why we were going to 90 days. And just very quickly, looking up the Spanish flu, it was 2 full years. And frankly, I'm thinking I might want to come back at 30 days rather than 60, when things might be a lot worse. I'm going to have trouble voting for that because of that.
And in the midst of that, Chair Constantine, Spanish flu, which I think I said earlier was actually from Kansas.
Yeah.
But the soldiers took it to Spain when they deployed for World War I, and it got reported in Spain, so they called it the Spanish flu. And then returning soldiers brought it back here, where 18,000 Minnesotans died, and in Minnesota passed the Public Safety Commission, which I, Berman, said, violated all of our constitutional rights. Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, I know that we're going to be hearing this, I think, Monday in Ways and Means, and I hope in the meantime we can get a few more answers by the time that committee meets.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I wanted to just go on the record and say that I won't have another chance at looking at this bill, and I support Representative Albright and Representative Scott's position. I think if we just struck after that point and left it at 30 days, that would serve the body very well, and I hope you will continue to keep that in mind. The nature, to Representative Mariani's point, is that the addition of the public health emergency, which is very broad in my reading of the definition, is exactly why we need to keep it to 30 days.
Thank you. The amendment, to restate, is on line 1.3 of the A6 amendment, is, well, okay, hold on a second. Now I think we have to do these as two separate amendments, because one is amended to the bill and the other is amended to the amendment. So it would be strike executive council on line 1.3 and insert legislative advisory commission as defined by statute Minnesota statute 3.30. And delete the new language. And the other part of the amendment is amended to the bill itself. So we should do that separately. So we're going to vote on this one first. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. The oral amendment to the A6 is adopted. We're now going to do the A6, and then we'll do the other amendment on line 2.21 of the bill. So all in favor of the A6 amendment as amended by the previous oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. The next amendment is on line 2.21 of the bill after legislature and before the period, insert a comma and the words, except when the peacetime emergency is a public health event that has been extended by resolution of the Legislative Advisory Commission. That is the amendment to the bill. All in favor signify by saying.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, but I believe the language was except when the emergency is a public health emergency, not public health event, was the language that I heard.
Yeah, that's right.
Except when the peacetime emergency is a public health event. Are we saying except when the peacetime emergency is a public health emergency?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's.
Then that is the amendment. Does everyone get it? Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Okay, so we have the bill before us as amended. Is there any other comment on the bill as amended? Seeing none. Oh, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a long week. I'm losing my voice. So on page one, I'm still very concerned. Line 1.12, the language at the end of the sentence when it says an outbreak of communicable or infectious disease, that it's just incredibly broad, and it continues to be even more broad. In line 1.16, it says poses a probability of, you know, and then it continues on. I don't know what that means. And then 1.20, again, the same question I had before, poses a significant risk of harm to a large number of people. This is just incredibly, incredibly broad. I would like this language either stricken or narrowed before we vote on it. I would like, particularly, I would like 1.20 strike poses a significant risk of harm to a large number of people. And then I think, Mr. Chair, you had pointed out substantial, on line 1.19, a substantial future harm is also incredibly broad. There's just the language in here is just so, so, so broad. It's
well, this is, does this language come straight out of the 2003 Model Act as well? That where'd you get this?
So, Mr. Chair, I think that this language came out of the public health contingency fund language. We talked about this earlier today, and I do agree that this needs to be tightened up, because the language coming out of that's great language if you're spending money. It's not tight enough if you're giving emergency powers to the executive. So I do agree that there's some concern there. And, you know, were we doing this on the slower track, on the normal track, I wouldn't come back to committee with this. I would have worked on it some more, but, you know, there wasn't really an opportunity. So I am very sympathetic to that view, and that Representative O'Neill raised it before, and we're just kind of talking here about how to tighten that up.
We can just strike lines 1.8 to 1.21. I don't know if they're amenable to that.
Well, let's see what
Mr. Liebling. Because they still got reasonably expected to require evacuation of a population, poses a probability of a large number of deaths, serious injuries, or long-term disabilities in the affected population, poses a probability, that's still pretty broad. Widespread exposure, I don't know if you need that. Significant risk of future harm, I don't know if you need that.
Mr. Chair, I would concur with what you just said. I think that narrows it, and it still maintains the essence of what we're trying to accomplish.
Well, so Representative O'Neill moves that lines 1.18 to 1.21 be struck. I don't know if this is a good thing to do or not. If I'm the health people, I'm going to say no, because they're going to want more authority to do it. I get it. But I wasn't totally sure about voting yes on the other stuff too, and I did. So I'm inclined to vote in favor of taking this out, because who knows? We're spinning the dreidel on this in any case.
Chair
Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm sort of inclined to do that as well, except that Mr. Benson is, we're kind of trying to figure out here whether this language, first of all, are these, I assume they're or. So it could be any one of these clauses would be enough to invoke it. Okay,
yeah,
so
that's the problem.
That being the case,
that's the problem.
Then we probably should take out some of them. If it was, because each one of them is not limiting it further, it's opening it up further and giving another basis on which it could be invoked. So, right? So that being the case, are we comfortable with, you know,
I don't think and is going to work, though.
Well, let me restate the amendment as it would be proposed by Representative O'Neill then. It would be deleting lines 1.8 to 1.21, and on line 1.15, after the word services, inserting the word or.
Yes.
so it did make it disjunctive. And then replacing the semicolon on line 1.17 with a period.
Mr. Chair, I think that's entirely reasonable.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm worried that that doesn't go far enough, though, because if we're looking at just what we know about now with COVID-19, what's the probability of a large number of deaths? Well, this is percentage-wise larger than what we see with influenza, but maybe that's not large enough. And we don't have anything in here that I think speaks to quarantine of people. So I feel like something's not quite right. I agree that 3 and 4 are maybe too broad, but I also feel like we're not quite capturing everything we need to.
Can you maybe work on capturing more between here and next committee? Okay, I'm seeing a north-south. I like that. Okay, well, that is the amendment as stated then, with Representative Mahler's cautionary statements taken into consideration. Who Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly to Representative Mueller's point about quarantine, the department already has the authority to quarantine as they see fit. They already have that authority in statute, so that doesn't need to be addressed in this.
We'll get something figured out between now and next. Okay, the amendment is, as stated, delete lines 1.18 to 1.21. After services on line 1.15, insert an or. And on line 1.17, replace a semicolon with a period. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, now I think we're pretty much good on amendments. We got the bill. Any final statements? Chair Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, I am, first of all, I'm very grateful to the committee for all the time and attention that you all have. Mr. Chair, we might not be done yet. There is another amendment. And this is a tweak to the data classification language that I think Ms. Krinke wanted to speak to, if that would
Do
be
we have
okay.
That? Do we have
we adopted that unscathed, the A4 amendment.
We already adopted that.
Yeah,
yeah, there's an A7 that Ms. Clark was just handed me that they were working on that is this to replace the A4?
We don't have it.
So this would replace the A4, Mr.
At
Chair.
At whose behest? At Ms. Krinke's behest?
It is okay.
Chair, I don't have the A7.
Yeah, we know one. I have them right here. Representative Lucero, the chair didn't know about it either. So it's up, you know, it's with Mr. Chair.
How many? This is just one other amendment we got? And
yes.
What does it do? It's
so,
data?
Well, Ms. Krinke will, I think, want to tell you.
Why don't we get it passed out so we can feast our eyes on it?
Good idea.
Thanks for the courtesy chuckle.
Chair Lesh?
Yeah, Chair Johnson.
I'm just wondering how many years since you've had a committee that we actually had to do this on the fly.
This is very rare for first termers. Making sausage and getting extremely dirty in the process. We don't do this that much. But it is important because, you know, we've got.
I remember as a freshman, we used to do this a lot more. And frankly, for me, the legislature was a lot more fun, more interesting to actually work with people and actually get stuff done in committees.
I'm with Sir Liebling.
Yeah, true. Okay, so let's make sure everyone has a copy of the A7 amendment. Need to register my perennial objection to classifying data as plural, but I'm not going to get into that now. Okay, go ahead. Ms. Krinke, did you want to explain this?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I just want to thank Representative Liebling for all the work that's gone in the last 48 hours of getting this bill in shape, and we're very appreciative of all the work. The language that was regarding data classification had some terms that really were of concern to the Hospital Association. Things like customer lists, we don't have customer lists. Things like income tax statements, things like data on patients, and including credit reports. There was a lot of terms that are not appropriate for nonprofit hospitals. Now, we understand that the Department of Health is going to want some financial information from hospitals before they give out loans and grants. And so we are very comfortable with the language that Ms. Clarkfest drafted that basically says that they can request financial information from hospitals, and they can use that to evaluate whether or not a grant or loan will be given. They can certainly ask about hospital margins, reserves, or what other information they need. But some of the terms that were used were just very uncomfortable to us: customer sheets, income tax returns, and other words. So I think this captures what the Department of Health wanted and makes it just sort of comfort language for us for terms that are not really hospital terms. So,
understood. Okay, any other questions for Ms. Krinke? No? Okay.
No, I have questions about the bill, or for the bill author.
On this, well, whatever. Any questions on this? Go ahead, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Liebling, in your discussions with Minkoji, did you have those directly with the drafting of the bill that we, or the amendment that we already adopted on the data provisions? Did you have personally contact with Minkoji on that, or is that somebody else in the kind of negotiated?
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. So House Research, Mr. Johnson, was working on this, and it was all by email. So he suggested the language that went in, and I don't have a copy of that that amendment that we adopted. If anybody has one, for that they can give me. But that was how that happened. So I didn't have direct. There was someone here earlier who said to me, "This is great." You know, they apparently that gentleman Matt Elling also he's. So he approved that other language, and yeah, that was what he was comfortable with, and you know, kind of Mr. Johnson mediated that whole thing. So that was what that was. But I hadn't talked to Ms. Krinke here about that, and it was just some of these terms in here that were giving her a little bit of heartburn. I don't know how substantive this is really, but.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thanks for that explanation. And I just don't want to undo some peace in the valley that's already been accomplished on the data sections. And so, and I know the Hospital Association didn't have their eyes on this adopted amendment for very long. Well, it was posted last night, I think, right? The amendment was the data amendment was posted last night. So.
Minkoji, I just got a text that said what? Apparently it's good.
The hospital languages?
Yes. House Research thinks it's good, and it comes from Minkoji.
No, it doesn't come from Minkoji.
It doesn't come from Minkoji. It's similar to the language that Minkoji suggested.
So it's substantially similar, you're saying.
Okay. All right, Mr. Chair, I just wanted a couple seconds to digest this.
No, I appreciate that. Okay, any other questions for the
Mr. Chair?
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, for presenting this bill. I've got a question about the Second Amendment, A7, because this anticipates that the only nonprofit healthcare centers will be getting the loan or the grants. If you use the initial amendment, it captures the other institutions which are not considered nonprofit. If you choose the second one, that excludes anyone else other than the hospital institutions. Can that be clarified?
Chair Liebling?
I'm going to phone a friend on that one, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that question. Because I haven't been involved in the drafting of this. Just to be clear, I'm trying to. This is going so quickly that people are working on it while I'm sitting here talking to the committee. So here's the new one.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Noor. Again, for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick from the Health Department. one of the changes that was made here in the A7 was to just refer to the financial information more generally rather than calling out specific things like a credit report or a financial projection. And our thought was if you refer to it just using an umbrella reference to financial information collected as part of the application, that might cover all types of information, given that right now we don't know specifically which ones we would collect. So it might allow a little more security in that way.
Representative Neuer.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think this is more broad-based information, so I think that will be determined by the department when they request that information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for the author? Then anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this? We're going to proceed to a vote on House File 4327 as... Oh, yeah, the amendment. Okay, all in favor of the A7 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. And we've got the bill as exhaustively amended before us, and there's no one else who here wants to talk about it. So, Mr. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've now adopted the A7 and the A4, and they both amend the same section. So we have to determine... I think we have to reconsider the first one that we adopted.
I think we can have the clerk work that out, right? Huh?
Yeah, one trumps the other, supersedes the other.
So we're reconsidering the A4?
Mr. Chair, I was going to say the same thing. Usually the procedure is you reconsider the one that was adopted, and then you...
Okay, which one do you want to reconsider?
So we would reconsider I would move to reconsider the A4 amendment.
Okay, all in favor of reconsideration of the A4, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. The A4 is before us.
No, and the A7 is before us now.
Well, the A4 is reconsidered before us. We can consider what we want.
So I'm going to withdraw the A4.
Okay.
And offer the A7.
Okay. Thank you. So the A7 has been moved. All in favor of the A7 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Hope we did that right, but we'll find out later. Then we have the bill before us as amended multiple times. Any other questions? I'm not going to ask for reservations because I know there are plenty of those. But the motion is that from Chair Liebling, is that House File 4327, as amended, be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes, and the bill, as amended, is re-referred to HHS Finance.
Thank you again.
Members, thank you. This is not an easy thing to do, and I'm sure we might have made a couple mistakes, but they'll catch them in HHS Finance. If there are additional issues, I'm sure we'll discuss them here. Committee's adjourned.